You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the November 8th, 2017 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. On the day before President Trump kicked off an 11-day swing through the capitals of America's Asia-Pacific allies, promoting a sale of U.S. weapons to Japan and elsewhere, he couldn't resist making another threat against North Korea, which he referred to as the problem, telling Fox News' Laura Ingraham that, quote, if we don't solve it, it's not going to be very pleasant for them. It's not going to be very pleasant for anybody. The peoples in both Koreas and their neighbor Japan are well aware how unpleasant U.S. military can be when it comes to unleashing weapons of mass destruction on those perceived as America's enemies. But real questions remain about the U.S. military's capability to defend itself when one of those enemies threatens to fight back and has the capability of doing so. In a past program, I suggested that the reason that the resident had not ordered U.S. forces to shoot down any of the ballistic missiles that North Korea had launched since the beginning of Trump's war of threats with Kim Jong-un was because of the likelihood they would miss their target. This would be a humiliation on the world stage neither the resident nor the U.S. military could afford to let happen. That's also the conclusion of Phil Giraldi, a veteran of the CIA and a frequent guest on this program, who wrote 2 weeks ago that underlying the American citizenry's willingness to accept that the military establishment could encircle the globe with foreign bases to keep the world, quote unquote, safe, is the assumption that the 48 states are invulnerable, isolated by broad oceans and friendly nations to the north and south, and protected, Giraldi goes on, from far distant threats by technology interceptor systems developed and maintained at enormous expense to intercept and shoot down incoming ballistic missiles launched by enemies overseas. In a recent speech relating to the North Korean threat, Giraldi notes, President Donald Trump boasted the U.S. anti-missile defenses are 97% effective, meaning that they can intercept and destroy incoming projectiles 97 times out of 100. Trump was seeking to assure the public that whatever happens over in Korea, Giraldi wrote, it cannot have an undesirable outcome over here in the continental United States, nor apparently in Hawaii, Alaska, and overseas possessions like Guam, all of which are shielded under the anti-missile defense umbrella. Trump, wrote Giraldi, was undoubtedly referring to, even if he was ignorant of many of the specifics, the ground-based mid-course defense GMD installations in Alaska and Hawaii, which are part of the existing $330 billion missile defense system. It is certainly comforting to learn that the United States cannot be physically attacked with either nuclear or conventional weapons, no matter what our government asks, our government does overseas. But is it true, asked Giraldi? What if the countermeasures were somewhat closer to 0% effective? Would that change the thinking about going to war in Korea or about confronting Russia and Eastern Europe? That's what I'll be discussing with Phil Giraldi when I get him on the phone about 20 minutes past the hour, and stay tuned for that. War Secretary James Mattis was already in the region in advance of Trump's trip, repeating the same warnings about North Korea that he had given earlier, by adding that the threat of a nuclear missile attack by North Korea is accelerating. Speaking in Seoul with South Korea Defense Minister Song Yong-moo at his side, Mattis said that regardless of what the North might try, it is overmatched by the firepower and cohesiveness of the decades-old U.S.-South Korean alliance. I cannot imagine a condition under which the United States would accept North Korea as a nuclear power, he said. As could be expected, throughout his week-long Asia trip, which included stops in Thailand and the Philippines, Mattis paid lip service to diplomacy, saying it remains the preferred way to deal with the North. With that said, he added, make no mistake, any attack on the United States or our allies will be defeated, and any use of nuclear weapons by the North will be met with massive military response that is effective and overwhelming, end quote. Do you recall when the Bush administration first tried to link Saddam Hussein with al-Qaeda in 9/11? In order to find another justification besides the non-existent WMDs for the illegal invasion of Iraq? When it wasn't true and those in the White House knew it? Well, it's time we recall the efforts by the pro-Israel neocons of the Project for a New American Century, who orchestrated the invasion and who fabricated the phony evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction when the CIA was unable to do so. And why is it time to revisit those unaccounted for and uninvestigated crimes? Because they're at it again. 6 years after the assassination of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan by U.S. Navy SEALs, we are now being told that among the 470,000 documents recovered from his headquarters, there is evidence of collusion between al-Qaeda and Iran. Writing in Bloomberg News on Friday, Eli Lake, a reporter with a well-earned reputation as a pro-Israel insider, wrote that Ryan Trapani, a CIA spokesperson, had told him that, quote, documents collected during the bin Laden raid, which had been declassified, indicate Iran and al-Qaeda have an agreement to not target each other. The documents, wrote Lake, indicate bin Laden referred to Iran as the, quote, main artery for al-Qaeda to move funds, personnel, and communications. And according to the CIA spokesperson, the Obama administration had kept these communications classified. What jumped out at me was Lake's report that Thomas Joslin and Bill Roggio, founders and editors of something called the Long War Journal, were given early access to the latest bin Laden files this week by the CIA. They say the latest information shows two wary rivals willing to cooperate against America. They focus, notes Lake, on a 19-page document allegedly from a senior al-Qaeda operative that gives an early history of the relationship. It began on friendly terms in the late 1990s. They, meaning the Long War Journal's Joslin and Roggio, write that the author of the document, who is not named but appears to be well-connected, quote, explains that Iran offered some Saudi brothers and al-Qaeda everything they needed, including money, arms, and training in Hezbollah camps in Lebanon, in exchange for striking American interests in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, end quote. It's likely that none of you have heard of the Long War Journal, but it happens to be a project of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a successor organization to the Project for New American Century, the pro-Israel neocon tank, the think tank that gave us the Iraq War. The foundation was founded the day after 9/11 as another beltway front for Israel wrapped like PNAC in the Stars and Stripes. If you follow the mainstream media, like I do, including NPR, you'll have heard or seen its executive director, Mark Dubowitz, speak against the nuclear deal with Iran, negotiated by Secretary of State John Kerry and the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. More recently, and none too subtly, he was urging Trump to demand more concessions from Iran before recertifying the agreement as Congress requires the president to do every 90 days. Why, it should be asked, did the CIA provide these newly declassified documents to the Long War Journal, an organ of a pro-Israel propaganda agency where both of its reporters also happen to be senior fellows? The answer may lie with the person who the resident appointed to head the CIA, not a qualified intelligence professional, but a former member of Congress named Mike Pompeo, with a professed affection for Israel and undisguised animus toward Iran. Just 2 weeks ago, by no coincidence, he was the featured speaker at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, where he attacked the Iran deal, and as the Times of Israel described it, Pompeo stressed that Trump wants to ensure the U.S. foe has no pathway to developing the bomb. The notion that the government would, quote, curtail Iranian adventurism or their terror threat or their malignant behavior has now, 2 years on, proven to be fundamentally false, said Pompeo, a former Republican congressman from Kansas, who keenly opposed the Seven-Nation Accord when it was reached, end quote. That's in the Times of Israel, which you can find online in English. Thus, while the U.S. is rattling its swords against North Korea, we may also be watching the beginnings of a countdown to a war with Iran. Washington and Israel's close allies in Saudi Arabia added fuel to that fire by accusing both Iran and Hezbollah of an act of war after a missile fired from besieged Yemen landed in the Saudi capital of Riyadh. Iran, the Saudis said, provided the missile, and Hezbollah, they say, fired it. The Saudis, of course, have been conducting a bloody war on Yemen that has taken the lives of thousands of its people and led to the world's worst cholera epidemic, and they've done it with weapons purchased from the U.S. and with intelligence by the U.S. Air Force. As President Roosevelt once said of Nicaraguan dictator Somoza, he may be an SOB, but he's our SOB. The U.S. has a stable of them across the globe. This past week has witnessed the 100th anniversary of two of the most significant events of the 20th century. The repercussions of both are still being felt today, but in vastly different ways. The first of them last week was the centenary of the Balfour Declaration, which marked issuing of a letter by Britain's Foreign Secretary, Lord Arthur Balfour, to Lord Walter Rothschild, a scion of the world's dominant banking family, in November 1917, in which the British government authorized the setting up of a national home for the Jewish people in predominantly Muslim Palestine, which was then part of the Ottoman Empire and fighting Britain on the side of the German Kaiser. The second anniversary observed yesterday marked 100 years since the beginning of the Russian Revolution. With Vladimir Putin nowhere in sight, Russian communists, now a distinct minority, were joined by left-wing activists from 88 countries in marching through central Moscow to commemorate the centenary of the overthrow of the Tsar, but it was a pale shadow of the grand Soviet demonstrations that had previously been held in Red Square, as much as Russia, now a nation of wealthy billionaire oligarchs, other than having an all-powerful leader at the top, bears little resemblance to the old Soviet Union. That both events took place in the same month and within days of each other was not, in my estimation, a coincidence, but explaining that would need to be a subject of another program, or two. What I will attempt to point out in brief was why Britain engaged with its European allies in a war with Germany that it was not winning, would think it was so important to offer to Britain's Zionists, a minority within the country's tiny Jewish community, as it was worldwide, a home in Palestine. The evidence points to a simple answer. It was payment to the Zionists for what the British believed was their role in getting President Wilson to break his pre-election promise to the American people not to join the war and then to enter it on the side of Britain, which, it was self-evident, would enable the British to win it. Playing the key role in the matter for the Zionists was Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. He was not only a close friend of Woodrow Wilson's, but the head of the American Zionist movement. The most common explanation for Britain's decision to set up Palestine as a Jewish homeland in face of an understandably hostile Arab resistance is that it was designed to serve Israel's interests in the region, but that comes apart when one examines British Foreign Office documents, particularly during the first 5 years of its mandate. From assuming responsibility for Palestine in the colonial sense, following the armistice to its hasty departure in 1948, Britain's experience in Palestine was nothing but a long headache. It had gotten so bad that by 1923, there was apparently a demand from within the British government that the Balfour Agreement be withdrawn. This led to a telling memorandum by Edward Cavendish, the Duke of Devonshire, who had succeeded Winston Churchill as the Secretary of State for the Colonies, which was quoted in Palestine Papers 1917-1922, Seas of Conflict by Doreen Ingrams, published in 1973. Hard to find. Note his careful choice of words. This is the Edward Cavendish, the Duke of Devonshire. British policy in Palestine during the past 5 years has been based upon the Balfour Declaration of November 1917. Briefly stated, the object of the declaration was to enlist the sympathies on the Allied side of influential Jews and Jewish organizations all over the world. It is arguable, he went on, that the negotiations with the Zionists, which had been in progress for many months before the declaration was actually published, did in fact have considerable effect in advancing the date in which the United States government intervened in the war. However that may be, it must always be remembered that the declaration was made at a time of extreme peril to the cause of the Allies. The Balfour Declaration was a war measure designed to secure tangible benefits which it was hoped could contribute to the ultimate victory of the Allies. These benefits, said the Duke of Devonshire, may or may not have been worth securing and may or may not have been actually secured. But the objections to going back on a promise made under such conditions are obvious. The Jews would naturally regard it as an act of baseness if, having appealed to them in our hour of peril, we were to throw them over when the danger was past. End quote. Those are the words of Edward Cavendish, the Duke of Devonshire, and His Majesty's Secretary of State for the Colonies in 1923. This was largely confirmed by Britain's second wartime Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, in his memoirs. Lloyd George made an additional point by noting that the German Kaiser was also attempting to gain Jewish support. It was believed, also, he wrote, that such a declaration would have a potent influence upon world Jewry outside of Russia and secure for the Entente, that is the Allies, the aid of Jewish financial interest. In America, their aid in this respect would have a special value when the Allies had almost exhausted the gold and marketable securities available for American purchases. Such were the chief considerations which in 1917 impelled the British government towards making a contract with Jewry, end quote. And the rest is history, which we are still dealing with today. So it comes as no surprise that none of what I've just read to you has or will be mentioned in the mainstream media's reporting on the Balfour Declaration's 100th birthday. That's because Israel's supporters are unusually effective in keeping what they don't want the public to know from the pages or airwaves of our national media. Another prime example of this occurred just 5 days ago when the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, a tax-exempt American charity, held its annual West Coast fundraiser at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, hosted as usual by the Israeli-American media billionaire Haim Saban and his wife Cheryl, who are well known to have been among Hillary Clinton's major supporters. In a matter of just a few hours, the organization raised $53.8 million, just under $54 million, for the welfare of Israel's Army of Occupation. And as usual, after these dinners, other than a brief article in the Hollywood trade publication Variety, there was not a single word of the event in the national media. The top donation announced at the event, and the largest single gift in the Friends of Israel Defense Forces history, was $16.6 million from Oracle co-founder and CEO Larry Ellison. According to its press release, Ellison's $16.6 million donation, all tax exempt, will support the construction of well-being facilities on a new training campus for the Israel Defense Forces co-ed infantry units. One would think this fits the definition of news, but it is more likely that despite issuing a press release to cover their tail, the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces would prefer the public not know what certain members of their community are doing for the soldiers of another nation, while thousands of U.S. veterans, many suffering from PTSD, are homeless in America's streets and committing suicides in double digits every day of the year. It's something to think about, but only you who are listening to Takes on the World and who will listen online will even know about it. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone. And welcome to This Week in Palestine, where you hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective through Palestinian voices. Today we feature the linking of voices from two different cultures, each representing a people who have faced ethnic cleansing, colonial occupation, and military exploitation, the Palestinians and the Native Americans. There are similarities to their struggles, which is why intersectionality is becoming a dominant theme of activist organizers working for human rights throughout the world. First, you will hear Farouz Sharkawi, representing Grassroots Jerusalem, and then Madonna Thunderhawk from the Lakota Nation. These two women have been traveling the Northeast as part of the Tree of Life tour, and these presentations were recorded when they spoke at the Lincoln Library. The joint presentations run close to an hour, so let's get right to it. First, the Palestinian voice of Fairouz Sharkawi.
So again, my name is Fairouz Sharkawi. I am the Community Mobilization and Networking Coordinator, and also I do advocacy at the organization called Grassroots Jerusalem. Grassroots Jerusalem's mission is to map and gather Palestinian voices that form a Palestinian long-term strategy for Jerusalem. Because in the reality that Palestinian communities live in Jerusalem today, we know and we see that the most crucial thing that we Palestinians in Jerusalem need is our own long-term plan for the city. The question of what's your vision for Jerusalem is the hardest question you can ask a Palestinian. And the reason for that is that Palestinians face a real threat of displacement from their own city. So Palestinians trying to protect their roots in Jerusalem usually find no time and space in mind to think, how do I want my city to look like 10 years down the line? So I will begin with the Jerusalem story to tell you the reality that we live in our beloved city, and then I'll introduce our work in Jerusalem afterwards. So, and again, quoting some of the things that Mary said in her introduction, the story in Palestine in general, but especially in Jerusalem, is of a continuous Nakba. Nakba is the word for catastrophe in Arabic. This is what we call what happened to our people during the war of 1948, when the Zionist movement established the State of Israel. Nakba, catastrophe, is the description of the uprooting of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, the destruction of 600 Palestinian villages that were entirely destroyed during the War of 48. Both my grandparents from my father's side are refugees from the Nakba. Today, I have no idea where their villages were. I mean, I know relatively where, but if I go looking for them, I can't find any remains to show me where my grandparents grew up. And the Palestinian people still live the Nakba. I mean, some people might think that the Nakba ended with the end of the war, but the truth is displacement policies are implemented against Palestinians all the time, especially in Jerusalem, where Israel has a very clear plan of displacing the Palestinian population, reaching a majority of Jewish Israeli residents. Actually, in the main master plan for Jerusalem that was put in the early 70s, the Israeli authorities speak of a demographic balance that they wish to reach in Jerusalem. I bet you're thinking balance, 50-50, but when it comes to Israel and the demographic balance in Jerusalem, Israel wishes to reach a 70% Jewish population, 30% non-Jewish, and that's their terminology, which of course in other main words means 70% Israeli, 30% Palestinian. And this is just the vision for the year 2020. That's the master plan called Jerusalem 2020. It talks about the vision for the city for the year 2020. And that is the demographic imbalance, if I may correct the term, that Israel wishes to achieve in Jerusalem. And the story I'm here to tell you today is how does Israel do that, and what are the Palestinians doing regarding these plans. So let's begin with the bad news, the Israeli policies in Jerusalem. During the Nakba, I suppose that most of you know the story of the Nakba. During the Nakba, the Zionist militias ethnically cleansed the western side of the city. The neighborhoods like Talbiyeh and Al-Qatamon and Al-Baqa, villages like Al-Malha and Al-Walaje were ethnically cleansed. And the west side of Jerusalem was declared as part of the newly born state of Israel. 20,000 Palestinians became refugees as a result, only from Jerusalem. I mean, in general, in the Nakba, the number reached 700,000. 700,000 Palestinians became refugees as a result of the Nakba, refugees that have the right to return to their lands and their homes. There are UN resolutions talking about this right, and of course, there is a whole list of UN resolutions that Israel does not respect. These refugees still wait to return to their lands And again, as I told you, my father's uncles and my mother's uncles are among those refugees. I have family members in Syria that I have never met. Now, going back, zooming back into Jerusalem, the result of the Nakba was the ethnic cleansing of the west side of the city. And the next war broke out in the year 1967, the Six-Day War. And the result of the Six-Day War was the occupation of the east side of Jerusalem. That is internationally recognized as occupied territory. And since the occupation of the east side of Jerusalem, Israeli authorities started making up and implementing those plans to displace the Palestinian population. And they speak of these policies very openly. I mean, as I said before, the most important master plan for Jerusalem says we're going to limit the number of the Palestinians to 30%. Today, by the way, the population of Jerusalem is around 900,000, both Israeli and Palestinian, on both sides of the Green Line, and the Palestinians make almost 40% of that population. That's exactly why, in more recent documents, that the Israeli authorities speak of 60 to 40 instead of 70-30. That's a bit more realistic, knowing that 2020 is just in 2 years from now. And the way Israel tries to achieve this relation is by, first of all, encouraging Israelis to move into Jerusalem. Israelis are encouraged to move to live on both sides of the Green Line. The internationally recognized border between Israel and Palestine is called the Green Line. And so more and more housing opportunities are built for Israeli citizens to move into the west side of Jerusalem, but also into the Israeli settlements in the east side of Jerusalem. Today, the number of Israeli settlers in the east side of Jerusalem is estimated at 200,000 settlers out of 650,000 settlers that live in the whole West Bank area. Now, encouraging Israelis to come to fight the demographic war is not enough. Israel also displaces Palestinians from the city on a daily basis, beginning with the legal status that Palestinians hold in Jerusalem. Palestinians in Jerusalem hold the legal status called a permanent residency. Permanent, the part of being permanent is a bit of a lie, because this legal status expires automatically every 10 years. So a Palestinian resident in Jerusalem lives in their own city with a permit from the Israeli authorities. Every 10 years, you need to go renew that permit. And when you go renew it, you have to prove that Jerusalem is the center of your life. That's actually the name of the policy that was coined, the phrase was coined by the Ministry of Interior in the 1980s, center of life. According to this policy, Palestinian residents of Jerusalem have to prove that they actually physically live in Jerusalem, otherwise they have no right to live in it. So as a Palestinian going to renew your ID card, you need to show that you either own or rent a house in Jerusalem, that you have a physical address in the city. You have to prove that you pay your taxes in Jerusalem, most importantly the Arnona housing tax. Arnona is the Hebrew name for it, the housing tax, which is a very high housing tax in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is an awfully expensive city. Real estate prices are really high, and so also the taxation for real estate. And in addition, you also have to prove that you actually practically live in your Jerusalem home, so you have to produce and show water bills and electricity bills. But it doesn't only end there. They don't wait for your ID card to expire every 10 years. They also come into our neighborhoods, to our homes, knocking at Palestinian doors in the middle of the night to check whether you are actually living in your Jerusalem home. So first of all, they knock on your door to see, are you going to open the door or are you lying to us and you don't actually sleep in your Jerusalem house? And if you are lucky enough to be at home and open the door, that you're not traveling or visiting family or just out late, then that's not enough either. And they will go to your kitchen and check. Do you have fresh bread and milk in your Jerusalem house? Because if you're having coffee and toast somewhere else in the morning, then Jerusalem is not the center of your life. And they will go to your closet in the bedroom and check. Do you actually have clothes in Jerusalem? Do you shower in Jerusalem? Because if you shower somewhere else, then Jerusalem is not the center of your life. And if you fail to prove all of these criteria, then you have failed to prove that Jerusalem is the center of your life, and you are expelled out of the city, your residency status is revocated, and you do not have the right to return to Jerusalem. It's needless to say that none of this happens to the Israeli residents in the city. Now, aside from the legal status, Israel tries to uproot literally the Palestinians from Jerusalem by confiscating our lands and demolishing our homes, because these are the main two things to hold you in the land. So on the one hand, the Israeli authorities, which of course control both sides of the city, do not allocate enough lands for Palestinian public use. The Palestinians make 40% of the population, but they receive only 13% of the lands for public use. In addition, Palestinian privately owned land is confiscated all the time. Usually, they use the excuse of needing the land for establishing what they call national parks and municipal parks. According to the Israeli law, the government has the right to confiscate privately owned land if the land is taken for a project that is good for the welfare and the well-being of the community. Now, on paper, national parks look good. But then if you look at the map and see that national parks in Jerusalem are confiscated from Palestinian communities only, and actually very strategically, the land that is confiscated is the last bits of land left for these communities to naturally grow into. So this way, Palestinian communities already heavily populated with no space for more housing for the young couples that get married have no opportunity to grow in their location, and those young couples will have to go look for housing outside of Jerusalem. Of course, once they go live outside of Jerusalem, they will lose the legal status, the permanent residency. In addition, there is a very direct policy of home demolition against the Palestinians in Jerusalem. Usually when the Israeli officials are asked about demolishing Palestinian homes, they say, oh no, no, let's be clear. We do not demolish Palestinian homes, we demolish illegally constructed homes. Again, factually, it could be true. Let's add a little bit more details to that statement. So in the last 6 years, the Israeli authorities have rejected 94% of the Palestinian applications for building permits, which in other words means Palestinians do build illegally in Jerusalem because the Israeli authorities do not allow them to build legally. So Palestinians who own lands and want to build homes, and sometimes not a home, sometimes it's just an additional bedroom and kitchen and bathroom for the newly wedded son that cannot find the land to build a new home on. So they add a mini unit for the young couple, but then any addition, any construction with a roof needs and requires a permit. And then when you build without the permit, because they refuse to give you the permit, that is reason good enough for them to come demolish your house or the additional room. Usually, by the way, when you go apply for a permit, they say, we cannot give you a permit because the master plan for your neighborhood hasn't been developed to include new construction. And then the question comes up of, who's in charge of developing those master plans? The only authority controlling the city, the Israeli authority, which intentionally refuses to develop those master plans and then uses it as an excuse for preventing us the building permits. So in short, Palestinians do build illegally in Jerusalem because that's what Israel forces them to do, and then Israel uses that as an excuse to demolish their homes. I also have to say that Palestinians in Jerusalem live in severe poverty. And that also is a planned strategy. That's not a coincidence. That doesn't happen in a vacuum. The killing and suffocating of Palestinian economy is one of those displacement policies that are used against the Palestinian presence in Jerusalem. And so in Jerusalem today, among the Palestinian residents, there is an 80% poverty rate. Imagine a town with 80% of the population of the residents living below the official poverty line. 83% of the minors, by the way. Excuse me. In addition to uprooting people by taking the land and the homes, the Israeli authorities also make every single aspect of our daily lives a big challenge. It's a challenge to go to school because there is a severe lack in schools for Palestinian kids in Jerusalem. Today, the number of missing classrooms for Palestinian kids is 2,000 classrooms. That's thousands and thousands of Palestinian kids that do not have schools to go to at the beginning of every school year. In addition, existing schools face a severe lack in budgets. Usually Israel says, the Israeli authorities say, you use our curriculum, we give you budgets. If you do not use our curriculum, we do not give you budgets. And of course, forcing the Israeli curriculum is forcing the Israeli Zionist narrative on the Palestinian kids. Palestinian residents living under occupation, under an occupation authority, have the right by international law to learn their own curriculum, to learn their own narrative. Another basic human right that is a human right that Israel violates against the Palestinians in Palestine in general. In addition, of course, there is a lack in infrastructure. Our roads are not paved properly. In our neighborhoods, there isn't proper garbage collection. There isn't proper lighting of the streets. There is a lack of connecting homes to water networks and electricity networks. And in addition to all of this, there is a severe lack in hospitals as well. In Jerusalem, there are only 5 hospitals serving the Palestinian communities, so 5 hospitals serving more than 300,000 residents. In these 5 hospitals, there are only 2 emergency rooms. In addition, there is a wall that is isolating Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank. In 2003, Israel started building the annexation and expansion wall that some people call also the apartheid wall, which Israel calls a security fence. And this wall, regardless now, I mean, I would love to go into the discussion about security or not, but maybe for later, security or not, the wall sits deep inside Palestinian territory. I mean, you would imagine, I mean, I'm not a big believer in the saying that good fences make good neighbors. But let's say that Israel does. Where would you expect Israel to build the wall? On the border with the neighbors, not deep inside the neighbor's backyard. And this is exactly what Israel does with this wall. The wall annexes a huge part of the Palestinian territory to Israel, especially in Jerusalem. And this wall, in addition to annexing the land for the expansion of settlements, for the creation of settler roads that connect Northwest Bank settlements through Jerusalem to Southwest Bank settlements. In addition, and most importantly, when it comes to the Palestinian perspective, this wall cuts off the ties and the relationships between Jerusalem and the neighboring Palestinian cities. Bethlehem in the south, Jericho in the east, and Ramallah in the north. This way, political ties, cultural ties, social ties, but most importantly, economic ties are cut off. The flow of goods and customers that is thousands of years old that has been happening between Jerusalem and its neighboring cities has been cut off with the construction of the wall, leading to a drastic rise in unemployment and in poverty. And today, the Palestinian economy in Jerusalem is suffocated due to this isolation, and so leading to the rise yearly, a drastic rise in the poverty rates. Now, this is the reality that Palestinians face when they live in their daily lives under the Israeli occupation. And our own political leadership is absent in Jerusalem. As a result of the Oslo Agreement, which some people mistakenly think is a peace agreement, another thing that I would love to discuss later if we have the time. I'm sorry, I mean, Oslo deserves its own 6-hour conversation. But I can tell you that Oslo is another catastrophe that fell upon the Palestinian people, and mostly because it's a midterm agreement that during the negotiations for Oslo, Israel said, there are 5 topics we will not discuss for now. We'll leave them for the final agreement. These 5 topics were the return of the refugees, the final status of Jerusalem, borders, settlements, and water. you tell me what's left. And so, obviously, any agreement built on these conditions is going to help the status quo. And who benefits from the status quo? The Israeli occupation and the Israeli authorities. And so, Oslo, some people mistakenly thought that it's going to bring peace. Oslo did not bring peace. Oslo actually made our catastrophe bigger. And Oslo made our own Palestinian economy trapped within the Israeli economy. Today there is only one economy and only one market all over historic Palestine, and that is the Israeli market. That is the Israeli economy. The Palestinian economy is just a hostage for that Israeli economy. Now, in addition, another result of Oslo was the fact that the Palestinian Authority has no jurisdiction in Jerusalem. Again, not surprising. I mean, let's face it. Israel wants the city. Israel wants the whole city. Israel does not want to divide the city. And Israel wants to kick the Palestinians out. And so, the Palestinian Authority being absent with the Israeli threat on the Palestinian communities leaves these Palestinian residents living in a vacuum. Who's advocating in our name? Who is implementing development in our communities? Certainly not our Palestinian Authority. So these tasks are left in the hands of United Nations agencies, international NGOs, donors, the international aid system. And usually this aid that comes into Palestine comes in a top-down manner. So it comes with an agenda attached to it, a political agenda. I give the money, I tell you exactly how to spend it. I tell you where to put each cent. So this way, the donor or the helper, they come with their own agenda, with their own perception of what Palestinian liberation should look like, what development in Palestinian communities should look like, and they come and impose their own agenda on the Palestinian communities. Which means that we have no voice. We, the Palestinians in Jerusalem, have no loud voice. No one hears us, no one asks us about our vision for the city, and no one asks us what change we wish to see in our city. And within this reality, the organization I work for, Grassroots Jerusalem, was born in 2011, and we decided that we are not going to be another civil society organization that does the same thing or similar things that already exist and similar work that already exists, that we would like to start building networks between the different Palestinian organizations and the different Palestinian communities in Jerusalem so that they together raise a louder voice saying what their vision for the city is. So we started our work by mapping the Palestinian communities in Jerusalem. Our field coordinators went into the communities, had a lot of tea and coffee, sat with people in these neighborhoods and villages and the two refugee camps in the city, and first of all, heard the story. So first thing we do is provide that space for the communities to tell their story with their own words. So they tell you the history of the place, and they tell you the reality they're facing today. Reality, of course, includes mainly challenges faced under the Israeli occupation. And then the next question we asked was, so who's doing what regarding this reality in your community? Who are the community organizations active here? Who are the community leaders and organizers active here? Grassroots movements that are not necessarily registered as official organizations. And so we started also mapping civil society in Jerusalem. So far we have mapped 40 communities and 80 community organizations. And the profile for a community organization or grassroots group, first of all, includes their vision for Jerusalem. That's why I said it's the toughest question, because that's the question they couldn't answer when we started that conversation. I mean, you go and sit with a 50-year-old man who is active in his community for 20 years now, and you tell him, so what's your vision for Jerusalem in 10 years? And he goes like, Habibti. I have no idea how my community is going to look like in 10 years. I don't know if we're going to even have the land that's over there, or we're going to have the people that live in this community. So I have a demolition order over my house. My son is in jail. My daughter lives behind the wall. I haven't seen her in ages. So these people, the Palestinian people living, facing these immediate challenges, cannot answer the question for the far future. So we realized that we needed to do two things in parallel. The first thing is help the communities face and react to their immediate concerns by, first of all, mapping and finding the resources available for them to mobilize around these issues of immediate concern. If there is a land confiscated for a national park, or if there are 22 homes under the risk of being demolished for the creation of a biblical park, that is an actual story in the neighborhood of Silwan in Jerusalem, south of the Old City, then first of all, the community needs to battle this, to fight this battle, to resist the threat, the immediate threat. Only then can they sit together with other Palestinians and start forming that long-term strategy for the city. So at the same time, we also create the space for Palestinian communities and Palestinian organizations to meet and discuss long-term strategies, so that when someone asks us, but also when we ask ourselves, what do I envision my city to look like in 10 years, we can answer that question and we can actually work sustainably towards that goal. And that's also part of our advocacy towards the aid system, the international aid, whether it is the United Nations and other agencies or the donors, because the way they treat Palestine today is as if it is suffering from a humanitarian crisis, as if Palestine was hit by a hurricane or a tsunami. They give emergency relief, providing alternative shelter to families that lost their homes due to home demolition. They provide some economic generating income activities for some communities or community members. But if this help, this type of help, works only when there is actually a natural crisis, not when there is a human crisis. And what's happening in Palestine is not a tsunami. What's happening in Palestine is a political tsunami. And so there is need also for these long-term strategies, and there is need to help end the reason for our need for this emergency response. If you keep providing band-aids and not curing the wound, then we Palestinians will always need these UN agencies to be present and to help us, to provide protection to kids in the West Bank that are stoned by settlers on the way to school. I mean, if the settlements do not disappear, then there will always be need for volunteers to walk the kids to school so that they don't get hit by stones. And we think that is also true for the donor money that comes usually, as I said, with the political agenda attached to it. They tell you what to do with it. They think that they know better than us what's good for our city. So we advocate also that they take the Palestinian lead and that they follow the Palestinian prioritizing of the needs of the communities. Only in that way can the Palestinians actually overcome the challenges in a sustainable way, by a cumulative work, sustainable work that is building towards a goal, a long-term goal. And one might think, after such a presentation, that the situation is only black in Jerusalem. It's devastating, it's really bad to know what's going on there, but that's not the only thing that's happening in Jerusalem. Also in Jerusalem, there are communities that are resisting in creative ways, in beautiful ways, and most importantly, in sustainable ways. So to finish my presentation with the good news, and because I think as a Palestinian that it is crucial that you hear the good news. It's crucial that you know that the Palestinians are not giving up, that the Palestinians are not just sitting and waiting for salvation. I will finish with an example from the village called Beit Dukku. Beit Dufko is a village out of 9 villages that are located northwest of Jerusalem. These villages are farming communities. And with the construction of the wall, these communities have been isolated from Jerusalem, on the one hand, by the wall, but also from their own agricultural lands. That's a pattern that exists all over the West Bank. Farmers on one side of the wall, their lands on the other side of the wall. Keep in mind that the Israeli law says that if you own land, farming land, and you don't work it for 3 years, the Israeli government has the right to confiscate it. So we separate you from your land, we do not allow you to work them, and then we say, oh, check, criteria, check, it's there, you didn't work your land, we take it. So in the village of Beit Dufko, similar to many other villages around the West Bank, the farmers were isolated from their lands. They could only access the lands through what Israel calls an agricultural gate. Sounds great, no? The agricultural gate is a door this size in the wall that opens for only 1 hour a day. Half an hour in the morning at 6:30 and half an hour in the afternoon at 4. And usually, it also doesn't open on time. So you, as a farmer, you get to the gate and you wait for the soldier to come open the door for you, and you wait from 6:30 to 8:30 to enter your land. And then, coming back with your cucumbers and tomatoes and peppers, you wait and wait and wait in the sun for the soldier to come back and open the door for you. And in the meantime, your vegetables get soft in the sun. And you can't sell them in the market as fresh vegetables. And so, what can you do with rotten tomatoes? So, the farmers starting giving up on farming all in all, leaving the lands and going to work as employees in the or workers in the nearby city of Ramallah. The Beit Dufko Development Society, our partners in the village, came up with a brilliant model. They started providing seeds and plants to the farmers and then buying the harvest from the farmers. So whatever produce you have, we'll buy it. This way, they solved the problem for the farmers, right? So the farmers still can make livelihood, generate income from their vegetables. But then the development society is stuck with the rotten tomatoes. So what do? They open a facility, a little factory, processing factory, very small, modest, under their offices. And there, instead of selling fresh tomatoes, they make tomato paste and make sun-dried tomatoes. Instead of selling fresh cucumbers and peppers, they pickle them. And trust me when I say it's the best food you can eat. In addition, they opened a sheep and cow farm. They have a sheep farm and a cow farm, and they make dairy. Today, they make enough yogurt that answers the needs of the 9 villages around them. So also a beautiful example of self-sufficiency. And now that they have the animals and the plants, they have the ingredients for a compost. So they make organic compost. They started with one machine, now they have another machine. They make organic compost that is being sold all over the West Bank. And the model is so successful. First of all, many families started returning and they wanted to become part of this project. They come to the development society and say, I want to go back and work my land. In addition, other communities around the West Bank, facing the same reality as Beit Dufko, come to Beit Dufko to learn about the model. They come from as far as Jenin in the north of the West Bank, or Khadr near Beit Lahem, or Qalqilia, or Salfit. All of these areas in the West Bank come to Beit Dufko to learn this model so that they can do it, they can implement it also in their own communities, and in this way, sustainably resist the occupation. So it's just one example of hundreds that exist in Palestine, exist in Jerusalem. You usually don't hear about them because they are under the radar. They are local, they are very localized, and they serve one community. And I see it as my own responsibility, first of all, to highlight them, for you to see them, to put them under the spotlight, but also my responsibility is to help them find those networks that help them survive. Thank you very much.
That was Farooz Sharkawi of Grassroots Jerusalem. And now we present Madonna Thunderhawk from the Lakota Nation. Madonna Thunderhawk is known as the grandmother to a generation of Native American activists. She stood with her people at Pine Ridge, Wounded Knee, the takeover at Alcatraz, and Standing Rock, to name just a few. She is co-founder of Women of Red Nations and member of the American Indian Movement. Here is Madonna Thunderhawk.
All the work I've done over the years since I was young, back in the 60s, it's basically one thing, and that's our land base. Right here in the United States, west of the Mississippi, is where the larger land base is that we left. But my people and my ancestors come from the Northern Plains, central area in the United States, Northern Plains. No trees, just a few, I guess, that are imported. We have some trees around the area of the waterways, but not open plains, won't it? But our history with the United States has always been love-hate. Because this country was founded on violence and genocide, they glorified my ancestors because we stood and fought. We didn't go away, we didn't disappear, we didn't assimilate. Stood our ground. When they refer to Indian Wars, they usually refer to my ancestors. Back in the 1800s, when the settlers started coming in our area, they'd already been here for several hundred years. But when they got further west, it was the army, the cavalry, and the Christians. And they came, whiskey in one hand and Bible in the other. And the army had the guns. So as a result of that, we're heavily colonized even today, our thinking. We're predominantly a handout mentality from the same situation as Beirut was saying. They deal with NGOs, we deal with do-good organizations, religious, whatever, that are looking for basically numbers, I guess, still have that missionary mentality. And the local politics of the area is still frontier mentality. So that's the groundwork. That's what's happened. That's decade after decade, that's what's going on, that mentality. So to maintain what we have left, there's just pockets of resistance in what we call Indian country, mainly reservation areas in the west. It's large extended families that have a lot of Hunkar relatives. Hunkar doesn't mean adoption. We don't do that. That's a bad thing. We make a relative. Anyway, it's the continuing battle to save what we have left by strong extended families that influence the modern day tribal governments, which are patterned after the United States government. So basically what we're doing is holding things down in spite of the colonization that's still going on, the colonized thinking. Our beautiful example, our beautiful, wonderful values that we had, our ancestors had, anymore are just beautiful posters on the wall. Because we're colonized people, we think in terms of always looking up, and the poorest of the poor sometimes are the greediest. So those are the things we're dealing with constantly. But when it comes to land That's who we are. That's our identity. So these strong pockets of resistance, we keep that original fire alive that our ancestors had. In the past, it's always been a battle with government agencies. When it comes to land and resources, it's always been the Army Corps of Engineers. For example, in the 50s, Congress passed the Howard Wheeler Act, where they created, for flood control, they created dams on the Missouri River, all adjacent to Indian reservations, to control flooding. And there's now the largest freshwater reservoir in the continental United States is right there, the shoreline of my reservation. It's called the Owyhee Dam. And that was a result of the Howard Wheeler Act. And they built the dams in 1960, they opened the gates and started damming up the Missouri River. So we've been in this water fight for generations. So my reservation alone, we sacrificed close to 1 million acres to the national interest. So all this land taking, all this taking didn't stop in the 1800s. We're still sacrificing for this country today. And because we don't have the political power and we don't have the economic power, we have to depend on allies in this country. We depend now on religious organizations who aren't into missionary work, but they're interested in helping us on a survival level. And that takes on a lot of areas. But right now, our struggle and our fight is in the courts. We can't depend on the politics, because we don't have that. Like I told you, we don't have that political power to do anything there. But because our ancestors signed treaties back in the 1800s, and each treaty that was signed was a taking, and our ancestors knew that. Each treaty from 1851 on up to 1868 were treaties of taking, where our ancestors ceded millions of acres of land, but it was for our survival. And the treaty era happened because the federal government was weak after the Civil War, and they came in and they said, wait a minute, we can't spend $1 million a year for forts and skirmishes and fighting these Indians out in the Dakota Territory. The United States government was weak. So they came, established a treaty commission to come and sue for peace. And that was because our ancestors stood their ground. But we were weak also because of disease. There was European diseases that our ancestors had no resistance to. Things like measles and tuberculosis was taking its toll. So our ancestors would sit down with them and do these treaties for survival.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In today's show, we'll interview Dr. Carol Anderson, professor and chair of the African American Studies Department at Emory University, regarding her latest book, White Rage: The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We hope you'll stay tuned.
That commodities or cars that turn to global economy, where the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring.
Forces, slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of the brothers and our sisters. We won. People together can overthrow the system. We won. We got that love of the brothers and about criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise, democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we discuss a new book. It's titled White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We're joined for the hour by Dr. Carol Anderson, a professor and chair of the African-American Studies Department at Emory University. And here is Peter to introduce Dr. Anderson to you. Peter?
Dr. Carol Anderson is the Samuel Chandler Dobbs Professor and chair of the African-American Studies Department at Emory University. She's the author of many books and articles, including Bourgeois Radicals, the NAACP and the Struggle for Colonial Liberation, 1941 to 1960, The Eyes of the Prize, the United Nations and the African-American Struggle for Human Rights. You've written a number of historical things. Carol, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
I've really enjoyed reading through this book, White Rage, and it's really about how whites harbor, often perhaps even unconsciously, fears of black progress, and that that manifests itself in a variety of ways. Could you talk about that, your overall thesis?
Yeah, my overall thesis is that when African Americans advance, and that advancement is toward getting access to their inherent citizenship rights and to their inherent human rights, when they make those advancements, such as moving from property to human being after the Civil War, you see a range of policy initiatives just emanating out of government bureaucracies that are designed to undercut that advancement. We see it after the Civil War. We see it during the Great Migration, the Brown Decision, the Civil Rights Movement, which we often heralded as this wonderful achievement when the United States became the United States, where it really lived up to its billing, what it said it was, what it said it was designed to do. But then how do you explain where we are now? And so I look at those moments of advancement and then go through systematically through the policies that rose up, in fact, to undercut that achievement.
Carol Anderson, you're talking about cycles in the book, historical cycles, and you're mentioning that there is this sense of two steps forward, one step back, or one step forward, two steps back in some ways. And you highlight then that this is a consistent theme historically. What led you to the title, White Rage? What are you capturing, do you think, historically with the title of your work?
I'll talk about what got me there and then move backwards, because this is what historians do. What got me there is I was watching the news cycle when Ferguson was on fire after the killing of Michael Brown, and more importantly, after his body was just left there for hours on the ground in August as a signal to the community. And I'm watching the fires just erupt. And the pundits and the newscasters were all describing this black rage. Black people burning up where they live. Why are black people burning up where they live? And they had these very narrowed arguments for why black people were burning up where they lived. And as they're talking about this, I found myself shaking my head. No, they've just missed it. What we're really looking at is not black rage, but white rage. And then that's those moments of epiphany that one has, right? And I had lived in Missouri for about 13 years. I used to teach at the University of Missouri. And I saw what public policy did in that state. And I began to think through how, in these moments of what looks like advancement, in fact, we have policies that undercut it. And policies that actually erode the vibrancy of American democracy. They erode the vibrancy of what the United States could be, its potential. And that's how I came to White Rage. That and it's also to make it clear that it's not what we often think of as rage in terms of like the Klan burning a cross or throwing the N-word around or anything like that. This is the kind of rage that moves very coolly, very methodically, very systematically, and it often cloaks itself in this beautiful patriotic language of, say, protecting the integrity of the ballot box, of ensuring the sanctity of neighborhood schools.
Carol Anderson, I just wanted to interject momentarily because you yourself in your book, White Rage, you put it so well when you talked about buzzwords, dog whistles, and sophistry. That was one of my favorite lines there. But that's what you're describing here.
Yes, yes. And, you know, you think about it, how many times have we heard those kind of dog whistles? The dog whistles of, you know, we have to have law and order. Who could be against law and order? Right? So it sounds so, oh.
Who could possibly oppose it, right?
Yeah, who could possibly oppose it? Except when you pull back the veneer, and that's really what I've worked on doing in this, is pulling back the veneer so we can see historically how this thing works over time. And what you have, because it's also going after several of the myths. So the myths that, well, you know, either Lincoln freed the slaves, so I don't know why black people can't make it, or that it was all over, all of the discrimination was over by the time of the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. I don't know why black people can't make it. But what you see here are African Americans, despite all of the odds, pushing forward with incredible resilience and being punished for that resilience. So think about it. You have children who are fighting to get an education. This is what we say we want and value in this society, right? We want kids who love to learn. You have children fighting to get an education, and you then have governors and legislatures shutting down their public schools. Wow. That's white rage.
Carol, you trace historically this white rage and how it manifests itself over 200 years and probably even before that. But, I mean, you start after the Civil War. You talk about the black codes that were implemented in many states around the country even after Emancipation Proclamation. You talk about the history of Lincoln even trying to get blacks to move to Panama and other places in the world to separate out. So those histories come right up to the present. They come right up to the current candidacy saying, take back America, which certainly is coded for white people take back America. Is that how you see it?
It is so ahistorical. You know, there's a candidate for Congress in Tennessee just put up a billboard, make America white again, right? And I want to say, again?
Yeah, indeed.
Sorry, but there were some folks here before you, right? But it's part of a powerful narrative that is driving the current impulse to, quote unquote, make America great again. That's driving the take back our country movement. This kind of sense of an incredible loss against the maddening hordes or something. And I really believe that what is so important is that we get our history right, that we really understand what happened and why. Now, there are some folks that you can't convince. That's just the nature of this beast. But there are those who just don't know, and that we've got to make it clear how this came to be. Why don't schools function? Why do our cities look the way they look? Why are we looking at state budgets that are cracking under the weight of mass incarceration when, in fact, we know that a better investment would be actually in education, would be in providing really decent health care? So something is going on. And so this book looks at those kinds of priorities as a society that we are setting, that we have a choice to make. And when we make the right ones, things are good. We allow white rage to work. It goes off the rails.
Carol, the term white rage, certainly for people who harbor overt racism, they're just going to say, that just doesn't make sense.
Right.
But what I like to call liberal ostriches, who really say, oh, I'm not racist, and don't have any understanding of the depth and the history that they're immersed in, that they grew up in, and how that manifests itself even today. To get some of the history here, the black codes, Why were those needed after the Civil War?
So the black codes were needed because now you have African Americans who had been seen legally as property now being human beings, and human beings who are demanding their citizenship rights. And so here you have an incredible advancement. And those citizenship rights include the right to vote. And the black codes were designed to basically reinscribe slavery by another name. So what they did was, and they, states like Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, what they did was they passed legislation that said, if you were black, and because understand that the black codes were for black people only, if you were black, you had to prove that you had a job. If you did not have proof of employment, you either had to sign a labor contract that would last a year, and you couldn't leave that employer regardless of wages, regardless of how poorly you were treated, regardless if the plantation owner was whipping you, or you would be a vagrant and arrested by the criminal justice system, right, and put through that criminal justice system where your labor would then be auctioned off to a plantation owner, to a lumber mill owner, to a mine owner. And you would then have to work off what they had paid to get you out of jail. Whatever it did, whatever your status was, it meant that your labor was owned by somebody else and you had no right to take that labor anywhere. I mean, you want to talk about undermining the capitalist system?
This is indentured servitude.
Yes, it is. This was law after law after law. You're just watching these black codes erupt across the old South, the post-Civil War South, as a way to dragoon black labor into rebuilding the South, but not having to pay for it.
And Carol Anderson, add to that, of course, the literacy tests and the so-called grandfather clause.
Yes.
The assaults were numerous and coming from multiple angles, generated from really a generation of racist, white, former slave owners that were legislators.
Yes, and you really see the rise of these because in there's that fluid moment where black people are fighting back. They're building their own schools. You've got federal troops there after Andrew Johnson has to go away.
Well, that early Reconstruction period, there's a lot of positive changes.
There were a lot of positive changes during the radical Republican Reconstruction. During the presidential Reconstruction days with Andrew Johnson, not so good.
No, and Grant, and you're right, and then up to the Hayes Compromise, not much of a compromise for African Americans, that's for sure. We're speaking with historian Carol Anderson. Her new book is White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We'll continue the conversation with Carol Anderson after this brief musical break. Please stay with us.
Said, hey, little boy, you can't go where the others go. You don't look like they do. Said, hey, old man, how can you stand to think that way? Did you really think about it before you made the rules? He said, that's just the way it is. Some things will never change. That's just the way it is. Oh, but don't you believe that? Yeah.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're speaking with Professor Carol Anderson. Her latest book is White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Before the break, Carol Anderson, we were starting to get into the black codes and some of the many challenges, institutional challenges, let's call them what they were, institutionally racist statutes that birthed what later becomes known as Jim Crow. And we know that those were segregation laws that eventually lead to the Plessy versus Ferguson case in 1896. Can you walk us up through this period? Because there's this brief window after the Civil War where there's hope. There are some things that are changing. But then, as you illustrated before the break, this shuts down through Andrew Johnson and then through the Hayes presidency, certainly the train wreck of a Grant presidency. Take us here through what becomes one of the most significant impediments for African-American equality via Jim Crow.
So there you have, because the Supreme Court during that era has issued a series of rulings that undercut Congress's intent on ending slavery, the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery, the 14th Amendment, saying you are a citizen if you are born in the United States, and which also outlines due process. And the 15th Amendment, the right to vote.
For African-American men.
Yes. And so the U.S. Supreme Court systematically went through each one of those and said, no, that's not what that means. So you get that the 14th Amendment is really not about citizenship rights, but it is about the rights of corporations as people. That's where the due process lies. And that what it also means is that any kind of civil right that you think you have has to be handled by the state. It is the state that has the authority over civil rights. Now, what that means is you're putting civil rights in the hands of Mississippi, in the hands of Alabama. You're putting the civil rights in the hands of folks who in their constitutional conventions have said, this is a government made for the white race, to the benefit of the white race, and those of African descent have no rights. That's what the Supreme Court did. So by the time we get to the 1890s, we're looking at a series of Supreme Court decisions that have not just gutted, but have given sanction to embedded racial inequality in the United States. I'll just take the one decision, the Williams decision coming out of Mississippi that I talk about in the book. In that Williams decision, the Mississippi Supreme Court said, okay, so it's really clear that the state legislature, recognizing that it can't just discriminate against the Negro. It just can't say, no, Negroes can't vote. But what it's going to do is identify the characteristics and then put those as the barriers to the right to vote. The U.S. Supreme Court looks at this and says, you know, the Mississippi Supreme Court said this, and the Mississippi Supreme Court is right. But we're going to allow the poll tax, because what those barriers were literacy. Because when you deny education, when you shut down schools, what you are doing is you are embedding illiteracy into a population. And what it also did was to deal with issues of poverty. So by linking literacy and poverty, boom, you have cut off the right to vote so intensely that by 1942 in the midterm election, only 3% of eligible voters in the poll tax states actually voted. That's the power of the poll tax.
And of course, there was an end around of the poll tax, certainly the literacy test more significantly. Can you talk to people about that, the grandfather clause as the end around for poor or illiterate, uneducated whites? Talk about the racial divide, right? This is sort of the schism. This is the plutocratic establishment insertion of this pitting of races against one another, the right. Divide and conquer kind of technique.
What the grandfather clause did was it said that if your grandfather voted in the 1860 election, then you too were eligible to vote. Now, think about that.
Right. Let's think about it. Go ahead. Tell us.
That is that beautiful cloaked language. So you go, oh, okay. Who could not vote in 1860? There were 4 million enslaved black people in the United States in 1860.
That could not vote.
They were not seen and recognized as citizens of the United States. So what you have done with that language by saying, oh, by 1860, is to say, we don't want black people to vote. But you don't have to say that. You can just use that beautiful dog whistle language. And that, therefore, opens the door to poor whites. And let's be clear here, too. The way that this system works is that whites are collateral damage in white rage. And so you had a lot of poor whites who couldn't vote because they weren't the right kind of whites. And you had the registrar going, no, you can't vote. No, you can't vote. But there were some poor whites who could. It is the way that the system works. And I'm getting ready to hop forward to Lee Atwater's quote to make that point going backwards.
Indeed. Please do. That's a fantastic quote that you shared in your work.
Lee Atwater was the political strategist for Ronald Reagan. And after the Civil Rights Movement, they knew that they couldn't use the same kind of overtly racist language that had been used previously, say, by Theodore Bilbo out of Mississippi. And so Atwater says, you know, in 1954, you could say the N-word, 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 N-word. But by 1968, you can't. It hurts you. It backfires. So you use other words like forced busing, states' rights, and everything that you're talking about, there are these economic things like cutting taxes. But the point is that blacks get hurt worse than whites. Now, that's the key phrase there, that blacks get hurt worse than whites. So you have a policy mantra, a framework being set up that targets blacks, but understands that whites are going to get hurt and they're just acceptable collateral damage.
And you would bring that right up to the present with
Absolutely.
Voter ID laws
Absolutely.
Being placed in states all over the country.
Absolutely.
That blacks are hurt more than whites.
Yes, but, you know, so you think about, let's take Pennsylvania, right? Pennsylvania was one of those that immediately adopted voter suppression laws. Now, as they're adopting them, they made all kinds of promises. Yeah, we'll have some mobile ID bases for the rural areas because, you know, you have Philadelphia on one side of the state and you got Pittsburgh on the other, and then you have a large rural area in the middle of the state. Well, the state didn't come up with enough mobile units so that people could get a government-issued photo ID. And people were going to have to drive for hours in order to try to get to a spot to get to a government-issued photo ID. But these places weren't always open. So the state sets up, yes, you have to have this, but then doesn't provide what is necessary. In the end, what the judge recognized was that, you know, you have basically set up a form of a poll tax here where you're requiring something that you're not providing. So you have all the middle of Pennsylvania is made up of a lot of whites, elderly whites, who can't be able to vote. That's what this voter suppression does.
Carol, let's look back historically at the post-World War I period, where over 1.5 million black traveled to the North for the jobs that were opening up in factories and plants up there.
Yes.
And in many cases, they were recruited. How did the Southern whites deal with that? What was the resistance? Tell us that story.
You know, when I was researching this, I found myself just going, oh, my gosh. The depth of the resistance to black people claiming their own destiny was intense. So one of the first things they did was, because it was very difficult for Southern white leaders to believe that black people weren't happy with Jim Crow.
Booker T. Washington, obviously, is a glaring example of the accommodationist school in that regard, and that was a mainstay in black intellectual thought at that period up through the early 20th century.
Right, right. You know, that whole Atlanta Compromise speech.
Indeed.
Well, And that just played into it. So when you had black people just moving, leaving because of the intrinsic, endemic poverty brought on by sharecropping, by the horrific lynchings that were happening, where there was no justice to be found anywhere. So you've got economic vulnerability, political vulnerability. Black people are leaving because what the war has done is it has created a need for labor in the northern industries.
So there's a push and a pull as far as the Great Migration goes.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is like vintage immigration, vintage migration studies 101, right? Push, pull factors. And with that, the South at first said, no, we've got to have some outside agitators who are stirring up our black people, trying to lure them away. And so they start passing laws about labor agents, those who are recruiting African Americans to leave where they are to look for another job. And again, I say, in a capitalist economy, part of what we understand is you've got the right to look for another job, a job that's going to pay you well. Not in the South. So they charged labor agents like a $1,000 license fee. In one city, they charged a $25,000 license fee. And again, this was like 1920. And if you didn't pay that fee, you could be jailed. And so it was a way to try to stop people from being able to get other jobs.
Slavery by another name.
Thank you. When that didn't work because black people just kept on leaving. One of the things they went after then was the First Amendment. That First Amendment deals with freedom of the press. Well, the Chicago Defender had been one of the major papers helping to spur the Great Migration. It was a paper that was absolutely fearless. It talked about you need to leave the South. This is not a place for decent human beings to be.
Well, they stood up to Booker T. Washington fabulously.
Oh, didn't they? They stood up. My mother would tell the story of my grandfather, who would get his Chicago Defender folded under his arm, get a little swag on as he's walking away and say, oh, I got my fender. It was a paper that showed that you were a person who respected yourself. And that paper not only encouraged African Americans to leave the South, but also talked about, look, we've got jobs, we've got housing, you know, this is how you can get out. It was an incredible paper. District after district in the South began to ban the Chicago Defender.
Well, and you had the Pittsburgh Courier. I mean, there were numerous papers, right, in these cities, and that's exactly right. There was an assault on the First Amendment.
A complete assault on the First Amendment, where you have a judge who is issuing an injunction against the sale and the distribution of the Chicago Defender. And let's be clear, there's not a libel law to be found here. Everything that the Chicago Defender was printing was accurate in terms of the lynchings, in terms of the laws, in terms of the sharecropping. So the assault is not that this is a scandalous paper, but in fact that it is a paper that is revealing the truth, so it must be silent.
In true muckraking fashion, you know, they're doing what the First Amendment and the free press is tasked to do as purportedly protected under our Constitution, and they certainly bravely did so. We're speaking with historian Carol Anderson. Her latest book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. After this brief musical break, we'll return and continue our conversation with Carol Anderson. Please stay with us.
Back down on my knees.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're talking about white rage, the unspoken truth of our racial divide. We are honored to be joined by historian Carol Anderson, who has written a fantastic history from the Civil War to the present about racial divide and the struggle particularly African Americans face against what she calls white rage. And earlier in the program, Carol Anderson described that term coming up after what had happened in Ferguson, Missouri, and also talks about what happened after the shooting of Amadou Diallo. We'll come up to the present by the end of the program. But before the break, we were in the 20s talking about the Great Migration. And, of course, there's a shift in African-American leadership at this time. We were talking about the importance of the press, the Chicago Defender, really kind of taking to task, as did the NAACP, a new organization at the time with W.B. Du Bois, and a new sort of cadre of leaders coming out of this period saying that the African-Americans, they shouldn't be accommodating the white power structure and that they should fight for the civil liberties that were theirs according to the Constitution. And so when you get through the 20s, it's a fairly tumultuous time. You've got the Booker T. Washington, the W.E.B. Du Bois divide. Then you have Marcus Garvey, Jamaican-born, coming in to the U.S. And the FBI is all over him, trying to undermine the efforts for early forms of what later are called black power and so forth. But could you talk to us a little bit about that decade, the Harlem Renaissance impact or effect, and maybe just take us through even parts of the Depression and World War II in terms of that concept of your book, The White Rage, and sort of the backlash to any form of African-American progress?
Oh, sure. One of the things I'll talk about is the Ossian Sweet case that I talked about in White Rage. And then I'll move briefly into New Deal, the New Deal, and then have us come straight up and through the Brown decision. So with Ossian Sweet, this is also part of the Great Migration. He was originally from Florida. Eventually, he moves his way up into Detroit. He was a doctor, a physician. This is in the 1920s. And this is a man who should be the embodiment of the American dream, working his way up from abject poverty, going to school, going through med school, becoming a physician with a thriving practice. But the way that redlining and restrictive covenants worked, African Americans are moving into the North. You see an array of policies being designed to keep them trapped in these very isolated enclaves. And so in Detroit, you had in an area called Black Bottom, which is where black people were supposed to live. In Detroit, the area didn't expand, but because of the Great Migration, the population did by 10 times. So imagine 10 times the number of people living within the same small, confined area. It was also an area that somewhere between a quarter to half of the homes did not have indoor plumbing. Again, 1920s Detroit, in an area without indoor plumbing. Ossian Sweet says, man, I'm not living here. And so he tries to move to a white neighborhood. He and his wife move in. White neighbors are just like, no, we don't want black people here. And so they form a neighborhood association. They surround his house. They're throwing rocks. The police are there. The police aren't stopping the neighbors from getting ready to storm his house and God knows do whatever. And all of a sudden, shots ring out from the house as the neighbors are surging toward it. Two people are shot. One white man is killed. Ossian Sweet and his family, the people who were in the house, his family and friends, were arrested for murder. Now, according to Michigan law, this was self-defense. But according to the media, to the police, to the prosecutor, who would one day be a judge at Nuremberg, and to the liberal anti-Klan mayor, this was murder. A black person who was a physician had no right to self-defense. That's white rage.
And Tulsa.
Oh, my gosh, Tulsa, where you had Black Wall Street. You had African Americans who were working hard, again, doing everything that they're supposed to do. And the result was that they were slaughtered. to the point where you had an airplane flying over, dropping nitroglycerin bombs onto the black neighborhood. And, you know, and if you see the signs, you'll see one of the pictures from that moment saying, driving the Negroes out of Tulsa. We call that ethnic cleansing now. So it was an assault on black progress. When we get to the 1930s, we are in the Great Depression. Here you have African Americans somewhere between a 50 to 80%, depending on the region, unemployment rate. So we talk about a 25% unemployment rate across the nation. For African Americans, it was staggering. When New Deal legislation came through, because of the power of the Southern Democrats, and remember, the Southern Democrats have that power because of massive disfranchisement, because of literacy tests, understanding clauses, good character clauses, and the poll tax. It meant that these folks controlled Congress. They controlled the appropriations. And so whatever FDR was trying to push through, they're like, yeah, but it's got to be whites only. And so you have really disparate funding. You have really imbalanced so that whites received much more in relief payments than African Americans under the guise that black people didn't really need that much to live on anyway. You see that the way that Social Security is devised is that the occupations where African Americans worked the most were excluded from the Social Security system. You have the rise of the Federal Housing Administration that embeds in federal law redlining, so that the way that the FHA worked is that if you were black in a black neighborhood, you could not gain access to a Federal Housing Administration loan, which took the loan out over 30 years and was at a much lower interest rate. If you were black and moving into a white neighborhood, you did not have access to an FHA loan. Now, the FHA, to put this into perspective, helped create the wealth of the white middle class in the United States. But it is a major federal program from which African Americans were all but excluded. Because if you're black and you can't get a loan when you're buying in a black neighborhood, and if you're black and you can't get a loan when you're buying in a white neighborhood, that pretty much leaves you out of moving into most places and getting a loan.
That's still going on today, Carol Anderson, including in allegedly liberal areas like Marin County and with major banks, including Wells Fargo. I mean, we bring that story certainly up to the present. But before we get there, let's continue and let's go through the post-World War II era. There's a lot of changes taking place here.
There's a lot of changes. One of the changes I talk about in a talk I give called We Fight, and it is the insurgency coursing through the black community that's just like, you know, we fought Nazis. We're not coming back here to deal with Nazis. So a change has got to come to America. And so part of what I track, and again, let me be clear, I don't talk about it in this book as much, but after the Second World War, there is a wave of lynchings that happened, particularly against black veterans, because they were not in their place. They were not subservient. They believed that because they had fought for the United States of America, that they had a right to be treated as American citizens. And the response of the white communities, no, you do not. You have the right to be blowtorched and dismembered. You have the right to be gunned down next to your pregnant wife. You have the right to have your eyes gouged out. Just a series of horrific events happening immediately following the Second World War. And what is equally important, and I think has to be stressed, is that then you have a judicial system, a legal system that says there's been no crime committed here. We can't find the perpetrator. And so you have this massive wound that allows this massive violence, and that white rage allows and gives sanction.
Or we find the perpetrators, like in Emmett Till, and they go free.
Yes. Because you have a system that, in fact, sanctions this violence, that gives credibility, credence to this violence, that legitimizes the violence. And that's why, with White Rage, I focus a lot on that structure, those policies, because if all we do is focus in on the Klan, then that means that all of this other activity, all of these other efforts that are requiring an enormous amount of energy, we just put our blinders on and we don't see, which was actually one of the big tricks after the civil rights movement. Let me take us to Brown.
Okay, before we go to Brown, Carol Anderson, we're going to have to take one more brief break.
Okay.
And this is Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. We're having a fascinating conversation with Carol Anderson. Her latest book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of the Racial Divide. We'll continue that conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with historian Carol Anderson for the hour today. Her latest book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We last left off before the break. We were getting into the civil rights period of Brown v. Board in 1954. And Carol Anderson, you wanted to continue from there.
Yes. And so here we have Brown. And Brown, the NAACP's initial framing of that was, okay, so Plessy v. Ferguson, separate but equal. The states immediately ran to separate. They got that, my brother would say, with a quickness. That needed no explanation. They were separating all over the place. But it was the equal part. So they didn't even implement Plessy. They couldn't get to equal. And so you had wildly disparate funding and disparate accommodations and disparate quality of schools. In Mississippi, for instance, in Amity County, African Americans were funded at about $3 per capita and white students at about $30 per capita. That's disparate funding. And so as the NAACP first goes after disparate funding and the states really can't equalize the system, there's not enough money to do that. The federal government had estimated during World War II that it would take about, and this is in 2014 dollars, about $1.2 trillion to equalize the school systems in the United States. So when they can't get to that, then comes Brown. With that Brown decision, the South had already been gearing up its arsenal. And part of that arsenal was to shut down the public school systems altogether and then take public dollars. Now, they would talk about it in terms of their dollars, but African Americans paid taxes too. Take these public dollars and then provide tuition funding for all white segregated public academies, so that white students could continue their education while the public school system was shut down. This was most obvious and egregious in Prince Edward County, Virginia, where that school system was shut down for 5 years. White students continued to go through and get educated. Black students were not. And what we know with child development, that 5 years is a long time to be without schooling. You miss so much. And the way that that the South just entrenched itself in terms of saying, look, as long as we can legislate, we can segregate. The Georgia Attorney General said, look, we know that a lot of the laws that we're passing are unconstitutional and that they're going to be overturned. But we're going to keep passing them. Because every time we do, it is going to take more and more time before we have to implement that U.S. Supreme Court decision. That is white rage. So here you have black children who want to get educated, who want to go to school. And the response is, we will shut down your schools. We will pass one unconstitutional law after the next to ensure that you do not get educated.
Carol Anderson, going from the civil rights movement forward, and certainly the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, the Economic Opportunity Act of 64, set federally some changes that were attempted to be implemented in many places and were strongly resisted by very angry white people. But the code words for affirmative action came out of that. And you very correctly talk about affirmative action as primarily just recruitment, or recruitment for jobs, or recruitment for schools, and essentially that's what it was. But for most white people, it meant preference, which was illegal, still is, always has been. But affirmative action meant preference for people of color, and that just brought out more white rage than ever.
Still does.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Mickey and I deal with this in the classroom all the time, and it's the mythology around that, you know, that like there was quota systems that had to be managed. You know, the only time that ever was a quota system was there was prior proven discrimination in a court order for, you know, a certain percentage, like one out of three hires. San Francisco Fire Department, certainly Lucky Stores here in California, a number of cases like that. But those were court-ordered things. It was illegal completely to have quota systems per se. But that became part of the mythology. And certainly the war on poverty manifested itself in a variety of ways with community action agencies at a local level, and in many cases empowering local black folks to engage in and be part of that process, challenging what had been an all-white welfare system in the country.
Yes.
And, you know, welfare, you know, the Social Security Act was for white women. And all of a sudden, there's a surge of black families going in under AFDC, so that had to be completely changed under the Clinton administration and eliminated, literally. So all of that has this history of countermanding any of the opportunities that were emerging at that time.
Absolutely. And you see this, for instance, in, let's take the vote. Right now, there's so much effort being put in to try to reinstitute the Voting Rights Act. So we get the Voting Rights Act in 65. The only way that act came through was to say that it had to be re-upped in 5 years, reapproved in 5 years by Congress. So in 1970, so we've got the Voting Rights Act in 65. By 1970, the act is coming up again, and the Nixon administration comes out against it. And comes out against it in that very subtle, cool way. You can't say, no, I don't want these black people to vote, because again, this is 1970. So what they say is that the act discriminates against the South. And that the act really isn't needed. It targets the South. That is just wrong. Now, the reason it was targeting the South is because the South had done so much in terms of denying black people access to the ballot box that it needed to be targeted. But the Voting Rights Act had enough flexibility as it went on that you had bail-ins and bailouts, so that all you had to do as a municipality or as a state or as a county was just stop discriminating. Quit trying to stop your people from voting. And you don't have to have federal oversight anymore. We understand this when we're so-called talking about criminals and parolees, right? But somehow when we have a state who 50 years after the Voting Rights Act is still trying to find ways to keep its citizens from having access to the ballot box, from having access into the say into their own government, somehow that state is the victim.
But it leads all the way up through the assault on Acorn.
Yes.
And the completely bogus nature of James O'Keefe and the attack on Acorn, and even though they were vindicated, their funding was gutted.
Acorn became the beard, as it were, the excuse to talk about rampant voter fraud.
Which wasn't rampant.
It was.
Election fraud is, but voter fraud is a different animal.
Let's be really clear here. This is some made-up stuff. It was when Greg Abbott down in Texas, who was then the attorney general, was trying to explain the rampant voter fraud in Texas before a judge, because right after Shelby County v. Holder, that horrific decision by the Supreme Court that gutted the Voting Rights Act by taking out Section 4, by seeing Section 4 was unconstitutional, Greg Abbott says, hey, we've got rampant voter fraud. The judge says, show me. And he can point to two cases where somebody tried to use somebody else's identification to vote.
That's some outbreak.
I'm telling you, that is rampant, right?
Two.
So, and Texas had about 10 million votes. So out of 10 million votes, he has two cases. Now, the way that Texas has set up its government-issued photo ID required to vote, though, is that in many counties, there is no DMV. There's no place to get that government-issued photo ID. Some people have to drive for about 250 miles to get a government-issued photo ID. Many of those folks are black, brown, and poor, which means then if you got to drive 250 miles to get a voter ID, you're talking about having access to a range of resources that aren't readily available to you.
And people glom on to these myths, these fictions, just like Reagan and the welfare queen myth, which, again, there are so many examples of this. You get a couple other books out of this. By the way, we're speaking with Carol Anderson, and her book is White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. And we're running out of time, unfortunately. We're going to have you back on, but we have to get into a little bit of the so-called war on drugs here. And, you know, a recent piece in Harper's by Dan Baum. You know where I'm going with this, right?
I sure do.
John Ehrlichman, right, from the Nixon White House, basically is quoted as saying, the Nixon campaign in 68 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black. Okay, right? This is where he's going. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities, arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. And I know some are questioning Ehrlichman in that regard as to whether or not he actually said this, but boy, does that certainly fit the pattern, Carol Anderson.
It so fits the pattern. I did a piece in Salon where I'm talking about Donald Trump and why the GOP is angry with Trump is because he has pulled back the veil of white rage in the GOP, that use of policies as a means to undermine and undercut black advancement.
He sure has.
And that here, and I use that Ehrlichman quote because what that war on drugs did was to criminalize blackness in ways that then undermined and undercut the advances of the Civil Rights Act as well as the Voting Rights Act. Today, because of the ways that the drug laws have been used, from the disparate sentencing,
the mandatory minimums, the privatization of the prison industry, Gary Webb's blockbuster story on crack cocaine CIA in L.A., I mean, on and on.
On and on is that right now where we stand, according to the Sentencing Project, is we have about 2.2 million, I believe, African Americans who have been disfranchised because of felony convictions. The bulk of those are for nonviolent drug offending.
Well, that's what Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what's also important to see in this is that a study coming out of Duke shows that African Americans are one of the least likely racial and ethnic groups to use drugs. And another study out of the University of Washington, one of the least likely to sell drugs. So you've got the least likely being the most incarcerated.
Well, Carol Anderson, there are so many things in the book that we didn't get to and so many other historical parts of this significant narrative that you have in White Rage, the unspoken truth of a racial divide. Certainly didn't get to the 85 MOVE bombing in Philadelphia and, again, so many other things that have happened, including the rise of Black Lives Matter. But, Carol Anderson, we'd love to have you back on the program, and thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show. Again, Carol Anderson, author most recently of White Rage, the Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Carol Anderson, thanks for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
And thank you so much.
Liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
That does it for our program today. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We give special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
overwhelmingly, the statistics around murder, around emergency room admissions and the like is men's violence against others. And in intimate relationships, it's mostly men's violence against women and children. Certainly in same-sex relationships, domestic violence occurs at the same frequency as it does in heterosexual relationships. So again, it's a powerful person using their greater power, be it psychological or physical, to coerce somebody else to do something they want them to do. And I see that all the way from bullying in school, in elementary school, even in kindergarten and daycare centers, all the way up through the Harvey Weinsteins of the world, all the way up to the mass shooters. And when I say mass shooters, going back to thinking about the majority of these mass shootings are really domestic violence involved. Right. And they're not these big church shootings in Las Vegas that we see. They're more 4 to 5 or more family members who are being killed by a shooter.
A conversation on male violence, from the mass shootings in Texas and Las Vegas to what happens in the home. Our guest is Jeffrey Edelson. He is the Dean of School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley. He specializes in working on domestic violence.
I think violent has, sadly, it pays. It pays off. There's a reward for being violent.
A reward for it.
I think there's a reward for being... Reward. Yeah, my experience in looking at domestic relationships where there's violence, in domestic violence, there's often... The violence is only part of a larger sort of coercive environment that the man or even a teenager in a dating relationship has introduced. So there's a lot of threats. There's a lot of coercion. In extreme cases, there are threats of, I'll kill you, or I'll kill myself. There are a lot of suicide threats, and that kind of coercion does pay off because people are fearful of it, and they then sort of follow through on whatever the coercing person wants them to do.
Jeffrey Edelson, next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Senate Republicans are preparing to unveil sweeping tax legislation that would usher in billions in cuts for corporations and the wealthy, repeal the federal deduction for state and local taxes, and likely compress personal income tax brackets from 7 to 4. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the middle class will benefit.
With this tax reform plan, the American people will know that relief is on the way for you and your family. We want to make taxes lower, simpler, and fairer.
Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Republicans have been crafting the bill in secret without allowing Democrats to participate. He said the Senate bill, like the one in the House, is grounded in tax cuts for corporations and the very wealthy.
A New York Times analysis found that next year, the House Republican plan would cause taxes to go up on one-third of middle-class families. By 2026, taxes would go up on nearly half of all middle-class families. And it hurts certain middle-class people much worse than others. People who have student loans, people who have high medical expenses, people who come from states where there are large property taxes, people who have big mortgages. These are middle-class people. They should not get a tax increase.
The Tax Writing House Ways and Means Committee planned to vote on its version of the legislation today, sending it to the full House. There is opposition by some Republicans in higher tax states whose constituents would suffer most from the loss of deductions for state and local taxes. But Republican Speaker Paul Ryan predicted the measure will clear the House.
Trust me, we're going to get this over the finish line. We're going to get this over the finish line because we need to get this done for American families. We need to get this done for people who will be helped by simpler, fairer taxes.
The ranking Democrat on the House Ways and Means Committee said the changes skew to the wealthy. Richard Neal said the measure will hurt the poor and middle class.
We're being asked to repeal the estate tax so that we can pay for getting rid of the tax that the sickest in America, the deduction that the sickest people in America take advantage of to pay their health care bills. Yesterday, one of them said, oh, so students can have $200 worth of interest deductions a year? There's $1 trillion worth of student debt in America. $1 trillion worth of student debt. Shaving back municipal tax exemption, gone.
The three richest people in the country now own more wealth than the bottom 50% of the U.S. population. That's according to a new report released by the Institute for Policy Studies. It's called Billionaire Bonanza. The report also finds the 400 richest individuals own more wealth than the bottom 64% of the population. Pervasive poverty means one in five households have zero or negative net worth. The report's authors write the U.S. is becoming a hereditary aristocracy of wealth and power. President Donald Trump sought to present a united front with Chinese President Xi Jinping following 2 days of meetings despite lingering differences over trade and North Korea. On trade, Trump said China had taken advantage of the U.S. in the past, but he doesn't blame the country for that.
And I have great respect for you for that because you're representing China. But it's too bad that past administrations allowed it to get so far out of kilter.
Trump said China must immediately address the unfair trade practices that drive what he called a shockingly large trade deficit, along with barriers to market access, forced technology transfers, and intellectual property theft. But to applause, Trump said, I give China great credit. During the presidential campaign, Trump accused China of raping the U.S. on trade. An environmental group and two Pennsylvania children have filed suit against the Trump administration to prevent the rollback of policies, programs, laws, and rules that address climate change and its consequences. Hausfeld, a global litigation firm, filed the suit on behalf of the Clean Air Council in Philadelphia and two children. The lawsuit challenges the administration's policies rolling back environmental protections, including pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, ending requirements that oil and gas companies report methane emissions, proposing the repeal of the Clean Power Plan, and more. The suit argues the Trump administration's actions will cause irreversible and catastrophic harm to the natural systems critical to plaintiffs' rights to life, liberty, and property. The suit also claims the administration is using junk science to wage a war on facts, data, and reliable principles and methods arising out of scientific, technical, and specialized knowledge. The suit claims one of the plaintiffs, a 7-year-old, is experiencing allergies, worsening asthma, anxiety about the future, and limited outdoor activities due to extreme weather brought on by climate change. A leading environmental group says California Governor Jerry Brown's reputation as a climate hero is undeserved. The Center for Biological Diversity traveled to the climate conference in Bonn, Germany, ahead of Brown's arrival there. It unveiled its report called Oil Stain. Jean Sue is the center's associate conservation director.
Jerry Brown will arrive here and has been lauded internationally as a climate hero and a climate crusader. And in fact, that is completely antithetical to what is happening in California right now. A true climate hero in California is someone who would actually be bold enough to take and tackle and phase out fossil fuel production. You cannot have a renewable energy policy while at the same time continue to also expand and encourage oil production in California.
Sue called for a ban on all fracking and an end to new oil development in California as the state pursues a renewable energy future. California is the nation's third largest oil producing state. The Center for Biological Diversity said much of that oil is highly carbon intensive. The United Nations and more than 20 aid groups are warning that the Saudi-led coalition's tightening of a blockade on war-torn Yemen could bring millions of people closer to starvation and death. United Nations humanitarian chief Mark Lowcock said unless the coalition lifts its blockade, Yemen will face the largest famine the world has seen in decades.
It will not be like the famine that we saw in South Sudan earlier in the year, where tens of thousands of people were affected. It will not be like the famine which cost 250,000 people their lives in Somalia in 2011. It will be the largest famine the world has seen for many decades, with millions of victims.
The Saudi-led coalition closed all ports and halted aid shipments after Yemen's Houthi rebels fired a ballistic missile over the weekend that was intercepted near Riyadh. The U.S. provides weapons to Saudi Arabia and in-air refueling for its warplanes carrying out bombing raids over Yemen. The California NAACP is asking state lawmakers to approve a resolution calling for replacement of the Star Spangled Banner as the national anthem. The Sacramento Bee reports the NAACP calls the anthem one of the most racist, pro-slavery, anti-black songs in the American lexicon. Opponents of the anthem point to a passage they say glorifies the death of runaway slaves who fought with the British during the War of 1812. The anthem's author, Francis Scott Key, was a slave owner himself and fierce opponent of abolition. It wasn't immediately clear whether the California NAACP has found an author to carry its proposed legislation. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Chesrich. The statistics are overwhelming. The Department of Justice says that 90% of homicides in this country are committed by men, and 80% of people arrested for a violent crime are also men, and 97.5% of mass shootings are carried out by men as well. Well, today we want to have a conversation about men and violence. And joining me here in the studio for that conversation is Jeffrey Edelson. Jeffrey Edelson is the Dean of School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley. He specializes in domestic violence, and we will be talking about that as well, and the connection to all these things from Texas and Vegas to what happens more at home. Jeffrey Edelson, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio station. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Mitch.
What do we know about men and violence?
Oh, well, a lot of the statistics you just read off, that men are the primary perpetrators of violence. They aren't the only, but they're the primary perpetrators. Ironically, men are the most likely victim of violence as well. Mm. So male-on-male violence is very frequent in our country. The violence, as you mentioned, we see it across the spectrum. So stranger to stranger, but a lot of it is domestic and people that know each other. We know from rape statistics that most women are raped by somebody that they know or an acquaintance or a current or former partner. We do know that mass shootings, so when four or more people are killed in a shooting other than the shooter, the majority of those shootings are domestic related, and those happen almost daily in the United States.
Yeah, I think there's one per day on average.
Where there are four or more people killed.
And when we say mass shooting, we think about what happened over the weekend in Texas. Yeah. We think about what happened in Las Vegas. Yeah. But really, mass shootings, the Department of, or the federal government defines them as four or more people being shot, not counting the shooter.
Right.
And that usually is domestic violence.
Right. Most of those are families, family members, relatives, ex-girlfriends, current girlfriends, in-laws, children. Children are frequently killed in these shootings as well.
Do you see a connection if 26 people are mm-hmm. are killed? I mean, obviously, that's a big mass shooting. Mm-hmm. Is there a connection between, say, when we talk about the lower level, the more common level, and one of the big ones that gets all the attention?
Well, I don't know specifics of the cases, like the Texas. I don't know a lot of detail about it. I don't think any of us yet know a lot of the
detail.
And that's
fair. I mean, some of this is speculation, obviously. Yeah.
Certainly, there are men who are generally violent towards their family members, but also towards others. And there are other men that really focus on family members, those who are more vulnerable and whom they can control with threats of violence. And often there's a long lead up, domestic homicides. The police have gone on average 5 to 7 times to that home on a 911 call before the murder occurs. So these are not unknown cases, just like the shooter in Texas. He was known to the military in depth. He was, in fact, incarcerated for a year, receiving treatment, escaped from the treatment facility at one point. And so these are people that are known to law enforcement and society, and we often don't take seriously the danger that they represent to others, and it's often too late when we discover how dangerous they are. Yeah.
And you work with people, and men. You work with men who have been violent domestically, and we'll get into that. Yeah. It's commonly said that domestic violence is a good indicator, a good predictor, or at least people who have carried out the mass shootings of many people that we put attention on, that domestic violence is almost always attached to that. Is that surprising to you?
I don't know if it's almost always, but that thread is there in many of these cases, even in the high school shootings by students. Mm-hmm. A lot of them have family violence in their homes. In a study in Cleveland and Cleveland suburbs, Mark Singer at Case Western University in Cleveland found that use of violence in schools was highly correlated to a child having been abused or witnessed violence in their own home. So there is a linkage, and there's research to show linkage, even at school age violence, between domestic experience of violence and then use of that violence, both towards ones they love as well as towards friends and strangers at school.
Let me ask you what we really want to talk to you about.
Yeah.
How do you respond if somebody just asks you, which I'll ask you now?
Yeah.
Why are men violent?
I think violent has, sadly, it pays. It pays off. There's a reward for being violent.
A reward for it.
I think there's a reward for being.
Reward.
Yeah. My experience in looking at domestic relationships where there's violence, in domestic violence, there's often the violence is only part of a larger sort of coercive environment that the man or even a teenager in a dating relationship has introduced. So there's a lot of threats. There's a lot of coercion. In extreme cases, there are threats of I'll kill you or I'll kill myself. There are a lot of suicide threats. And that kind of coercion does pay off because people are fearful of it, and they then sort of follow through on whatever the coercing person wants them to do.
So a social dynamic.
A social dynamic. It's really a power play, and that power pays off in coercion and I wouldn't say obedience, but the person who they're coercing following through on whatever the threat,
That's the reward.
Yeah, that's the reward.
They're going to get their way, however.
Yeah, they get their way. And you see that we were, thinking about Harvey Weinstein, thinking about all these sexual harassment cases. Again, these are powerful men who are using their power to coerce others, forcing themselves on others, raping women, sexually harassing them, and then following through with threats of undermining their career and following through on those threats. And women see that. And it's not just in the entertainment industry, but it's across our entire society that women who complain about sexual harassment often will lose their jobs. And we need to change that. And the Me Too campaign and everything that's happening in society, I'm very hopeful that that will change. But, you know, that's just part of a continuum of men's use of coercion and followed through with threats and, in extreme cases, violence.
And that's important. Yeah. You see a connection between what we're seeing with women telling their stories about being sexually violent and sexual harassment to even mass shootings.
Absolutely. It's all part of a coercive control strategy that the more powerful men in these cases are using against women. Certainly, women in child abuse cases will use that same course of power against children, and sometimes men if they feel that they can have that power over men. But overwhelmingly, the statistics around murder, around emergency room admissions and the like, is men's violence against others. And in intimate relationships, it's mostly men's violence against women and children. Certainly in same-sex relationships, domestic violence occurs at the same frequency as it does in heterosexual relationships. So again, it's a powerful person using their greater power, be it psychological or physical, to coerce somebody else to do something they want them to do. And I see that all the way from bullying in school, in elementary school, even in kindergarten and daycare centers, all the way up through the Harvey Weinsteins of the world, all the way up to the mass shooters. And when I say mass shooters, going back to thinking about the majority of these mass shootings are really domestic violence involved. Right. And they're not these big church shootings in Las Vegas that we see. They're more 4 to 5 or more family members who are being killed by a shooter.
And you put all of our attention on mass shooters.
Yeah.
But that's extreme. It's not really where the
extreme.
Big problem is.
Right.
And we put all our attention on Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
But it goes beyond Harvey Weinstein.
Absolutely.
It's not just Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby.
It's tens of thousands of men in powerful positions across our country.
Is it just that? Is it more than that? Is it men culture? How we're raised?
I do think we're raised. You know, when I'm driving with my wife, it's like I'm always certain where I'm going. She's willing to ask questions, ask people for directions. I'm the one that's always, no, I don't need to. I know where I'm going. And I do think there's a socialization of boys to be sort of in control, mm-hmm. to be certain, to not express fear and scared feelings and insecurity. In fact, when I work with men who batter, one of our exercises is to talk about how do you talk about feelings? Because most men and even boys, when they think of fear, insecurity, and the like, it's interpreted as I'm angry. And when I'm angry, I lash out. And there's a famous article about 20 years ago said, boys are warriors and girls are worriers. And I do think boys externalize. They point outward towards others. Girls turn it more in on themselves. And the research across a variety of experiences shows that boys do that. They turn against others. And so we see boys using aggressive behavior much more than girls. It's not exclusively boys. There are girls who are aggressive and violent. There are women who are violent towards their partners and children. But overwhelmingly, this is an issue for men and men's use of violence against others in our society.
Is it taught? Do we learn these behaviors?
I think, you know, certainly there's probably a biological origin of this. And if you look at chimpanzees and other groups of primates, you do see men being more aggressive.
Is it
and
testosterone?
Males being more aggressive. I don't know. I don't know the physiology that well. But one of the wonderful things about humans is that we have learned to control our behavior and use our minds to put our bodies to better uses, and we do have the ability through our minds and to control that behavior and to redirect it. And in fact, if you look at murder rates over the centuries, our societies are becoming much less violent than they have been in the past. The murder rates in Amsterdam and other cities in Europe in the 14, 1500s were much, much higher than they are right now in the U.S. Even though we're concerned about it and we always want to lower the murder rates, we are getting better, I think, as a species in terms of controlling our more innate desires to use violence. But, and I don't, you know, I would not excuse anybody for using violence just because it's genetic or something like that.
Right.
I think we have the ability to control. We may be provoked by somebody's behavior, but it's our choice in how we respond to that behavior. And that's what I try, a main message that I try to get across to men when I've worked with them in groups for men who have battered their girlfriends or partners, is that you may be provoked, but how you respond to that provocation is your choice.
Well, what do they say to you? I mean, I'm sure you get many responses, but is a common response, I can't control it?
No, I think a common response is that if she only did something X, Y, or Z differently, if she only had paid the bills on time, if she had only had dinner ready, if she had kept those kids under control, I wouldn't have had to beat her. And my response to that is, that's your choice, how you're responding to those difficult times. Every relationship and every family have very difficult situations that they're in, but it's your choice in how you respond to those difficult situations. And that's really about, in part, what you say to yourself, your cognitive self-talk, as well as how you then overtly behave towards others. And I think we, as humans, have an incredible capacity. That's where I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful because I think we, as humans, have an incredible capacity to control and change both our thoughts and our behaviors.
Yeah. I want to go back to something you said earlier, and that was about boys having a need to control.
Mm-hmm.
And one way that, whether it's a person, I mean, this is how governments enforce control as well, is mm-hmm. is the threat of violence.
Yes. Yeah.
That's how you do it. I mean, governments do it.
I can remember when, I think it was even during the Reagan years, when there was a bombing in Libya by the government, and I was facilitating a group for men who batter at that point. We had to talk about what's the message that the president is giving about use of violence. We could certainly go there today. What is the message that President Trump is giving in this videotape that we saw and heard about his behavior towards women? I think there's a huge meta message out there. Maybe it's, you know, from leaders, and men interpret that. And I think, in a sense, President Trump's behavior in that videotape gave permission to a lot of people to do things that they might not otherwise have felt permission to do. So I do think our larger environment, and that's where leadership needs to give clear messages, our larger environment does influence individual behavior. And it's hard to be working on nonviolence and against sexual harassment when you have people at the leadership of the country behaving in exactly the opposite way.
He is not helping.
No, he is not helping. Not at all.
Do you think you'll see the results of this?
Oh, I think we already see it across the country in terms of men's behavior. I think we see it in terms of some of the people coming to campus in Charlottesville, the open bigotry that was exposed, that the marchers, the white nationalists, things that they were saying, they feel like they have permission to be open about their biases. And for a long time, I think we were working against those, and people were, maybe privately they held those beliefs, but they weren't saying them publicly and trying to recruit more people to their beliefs. And I do think absolutely the leadership that we have at all levels of our society does give clear message and permission for people to behave differently. I think that's a huge problem right now.
The high-profile mass shootings, in which dozens of people are usually shot, is also predominantly white men.
Mm-hmm.
But if we look at mass shootings as a whole, going back to the government definition of four people or more, do you get the same dynamic?
I don't know the exact statistics, but I know that it's men, primarily men.
Primarily men, we know
that.
And
if you look at the
white
homicide,
men?
I don't know if it's white men or not.
Okay, fair enough. We are in conversation with Jeffrey Edelson. Jeffrey Edelson is the Dean of School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley, and he specializes on domestic violence. Donald Trump, he was raised in this society as well. Mm-hmm. So he didn't come out of nowhere.
As was Bill Clinton.
As was Bill Clinton. Yep. And I think about this, and getting back to the point about Harvey Weinstein and what I said, but you know, he's a problem. Obviously, there are things that, you know, have to be addressed there. But but he's not the only problem. There are much bigger problems beyond these people. And it gets to this, and I've heard this term before, rape culture. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of time when people first time I heard rape culture, it might have been like the first time I heard the term white privilege. You know, my immediate response is like, oh, what's that? I don't get that. I don't understand that. But then you start to think about it, you start to dive in, and you know, you're like, oh my goodness, yeah, I definitely do think we have a rape culture in this sense. I remember being a young man, and I remember among my friends, you did not want to be the last person to lose your virginity, right? Mm-hmm. That our view of our own manhood, of our own self within our group, you know, was influenced by our ability to attract women. We were told women play hard to get, right? They always say, no, you got to be persistent on it. We weren't told to rape what we understood rape to be at that time. But I think society has developed a new notion about what rape is today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think our society has evolved, and our definitions of both domestic violence and rape and have been expanded. You know, rape is traditionally thought of as forced intercourse, but then we've added things like sexual harassment to the continuum. So we've started to see these behaviors in a larger continuum of behaviors. So the same with domestic violence. Stalking has been added to our laws. And so I think over time, as we've looked at issues like rape and domestic violence, we've expanded our definitions of what is included in these kinds of behaviors. So the same thing, sexual harassment to rape. There's a variety of domestic violence, stalking included.
There's going to be a party. There's going to be girls and alcohol, you know, is what we used to tell each other.
Yeah.
You know, and when I'm a young man, I'm talking maybe 20 years ago. Yeah. And this was seen okay, as being okay.
Yeah.
Well, at least it was by us. And I think by society as well, because you saw it in Hollywood films. Mm-hmm. You still hear it in music today and film.
Alcohol and violence, it's a good thing you brought that up. The research on alcohol and domestic violence in particular is that when I started in this field, if somebody was alcoholic or drug abusing, we would send them to treatment first and then say, come back to the batter intervention program. We don't do that so much anymore. The research shows that indeed the use of substances or alcohol increases the frequency and the likelihood that you'll use violence, but those same men, when they're sober, are also violent. So it's not a one-to-one. Alcohol does not cause violence. And I've heard many men say, well, I was just very drunk. It is an uninhibitor, but it isn't the source of that violence. And those men,
oftentimes it is seen as the source.
It is often seen that way. Absolutely.
Drinking.
And many men have come to me in the groups that I've run and saying, well, you know, if I just stop drinking, I won't be violent. But the women, their women partners report, and the research supports them, that men are also violent when they're sober, those same men. They may increase the severity and the frequency of their use of violence, but the alcohol isn't necessarily the source of their violence.
Yeah.
It's more about this issue of power and coercive control. And the This term coercive control that I'm using is a relatively new term in the field. We used to talk about individual instances of violence, but Evan Stark and Marianne Dutton, two researchers on the East Coast, have over the last about 15 to 20 years started to talk about the idea that it's really a pattern of behavior that includes violent events. But again, this is the definitional piece where we've expanded our definition. It's really a pattern of coercive control that includes violence, includes threats, includes a lot of different things. And in fact, in the UK, they've redefined domestic violence to be more as a pattern of coercive control. And they actually prosecute people for coercive control, not just a single incident of domestic violence. Yeah. So that's a big change in our field and in legislation.
And that's interesting, too, to see the legislative things that are happening. Even Congress is taking up the issue, at least with sexual harassment on Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
I just want to really make this point and then get your response to it. Because going back to the online Me Too sort of movement campaign, and women telling their stories about being harassed or sexually abused, it's basically every woman. I don't know a single woman who would say, no, that's never happened to me.
Yeah.
And if it's every woman, then it's almost every man that was a part. I mean, I don't want to say every single man, because I think there should be an ideal that we aspire towards, that we can achieve, but it's probably most men.
I'd say many. I don't know if it's most.
Yeah. Really?
And my experience is many of the perpetrators of violence are serial perpetrators. So in fact, that's how I got into this field. I was working in upstate New York. I was teaching at SUNY Albany. And the two shelters in town organized a meeting and said, we are seeing women who have the same perpetrator, multiple women coming to our shelter, and this one perpetrator is moving from family to family. I'd say it's many. I don't know if it's most. But one of the things that we do know is that exposure, early exposure to violence in your home raises the likelihood that you will be a perpetrator of violence. So it increases the likelihood 2 to 3 times that you're going to use violence in dating and intimate relationships.
Is that just because it's a behavior you're learning?
Yeah, social learning. It's being modeled for you at home. You're taking that as normal in many cases and thinking that that's just the way that I control my partner in an argument. Or when there's tension and I want something done, I use violence to accentuate my control over her, to reinforce that control. And I do want to say, though, even though it increases your likelihood 2 to 3 times of being a perpetrator, it doesn't mean that you're automatically, just because you've been exposed to violence as a child or been abused yourself. Most people, in fact, the majority of children grow up who have had that experience, grow up not to repeat that towards their partners. So it makes you at a higher risk, but it doesn't mean that the majority of children exposed to violence end up perpetrating that. And I think that's an important thing to think about, is why do those children who have those terrible experiences as children, how do they grow up to not repeat that? And I think what we talk about in the technical term is protective factors in their lives. And protective factors are often a caring mother who's protecting them from a violent perpetrator, a caring older sibling, aunts and uncles, your best friend's parents, and you're going to their house and you're seeing them behave a very different way. And that's the model that you try to live by later in your life. Often,
you have to do that consciously, though?
I don't know if it's consciously, but yeah, they do have these other protective people in their lives. They
other
have
models?
Aunt and uncle models. Teachers. Often young adults talk about a teacher that took them under their wings, and they had a great experience at school that was very different than what they were experiencing at home. So I am hopeful that there are protective factors. We need people to step up more. So in the field of sexual violence prevention, we talk about bystanders. people who know about what's going on but don't take any action. And I do think people first go to their family and friends, those people in their informal networks, before they seek formal help from police, social workers, and others. And I do think we have to reconsider our roles as family and friends and step up and both support victims, provide safety to them, as well as give clear messages to the perpetrators of violence that this is not okay. And in the whole discussion of Harvey Weinstein and others recently, we've all talked about and we've heard about it in the news that what did other people know? What did Harvey Weinstein's brother know about this, who was his partner in this business and settling all these cases? What did David Boies, who was an attorney on behalf of Weinstein, it was in the New York Times yesterday, what did he know about, and how did he facilitate the violence that was going on? So I do think we not only have to think about the perpetrators, but what's our role as a bystander to prevent violence and to give messages, clear messages of support to victims, survivors, and clear messages to the perpetrators that it's not okay and we won't tolerate it.
How do we do that?
I think we call
it maybe a simple, I don't just
yeah,
do it.
But. Well, I think it's, again, back to culture. We call people on remarks about women's looks, about sexist remarks that they make at work, how they treat their employees. I think we have to call managers on that and people that are in powerful positions. And the case of Weinstein and others is that people didn't call them on it. I think Uber is another case that we've watched over the last year unravel because of behavior often by male superiors towards their female employees. We saw it at UC Berkeley last year. There were three very high-level cases of one dean, one vice chancellor, and a potentially future Nobel Prize winner. And we saw how they used their positions of power to intimidate and sexually abuse or sexually harass subordinates. And the university kept it quiet and punished them, but very lightly, and nobody even knew that there was a consequence for it. And then it came out last year in the news. And in part, there were consequences. I'm happy to say there were consequences for the administrators that allowed that. And we can't, as administrators and as supervisors and even as peers, we can't allow that behavior to go on, and we have to take a stand.
So it's we're different dynamics here. You have inside the home, what happens in the home, one growing up, what you model after. There's a society, your own community, and what happens there. I guess we already touched a little bit on society at large and talking about the role the president could play. Mm-hmm. What about film, movies, popular culture?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we model after that too, don't we?
We do model after that. Think of the movie Pretty Woman, where Richard Gere and I'm blanking on the actress's name. But
I would have had it if you weren't blanking on it. Julia Roberts.
Julia Roberts, yeah.
Good.
Even though I grew up in North Hollywood, I'm not a big Hollywood buff. But, that was a prostitute. She's rescued by this powerful, wealthy man. And those kinds of images, and those repeat themselves in a lot of different TV shows, and it's not just prostitutes, but powerful men misbehaving, and then we get that message clearly. We see it in advertising, where they're using a sexy woman to advertise something totally unrelated to that woman.
Yeah.
So we see the promotion of women as sex objects, the promotion of sexualized behavior towards women. And I do think our advertising, as well as our movies and TV shows, do reinforce that.
And that's and it kind of gets back to what I was saying, just how I remember how when I was a young man, these things, how they were being taught to us. But what about today? Are they still happening?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. What's still happening?
Just the way that roles, and I guess we're getting into roles, right? Male,
Oh, yeah.
Female roles, these roles that we have. And
it's being modeled all the time, and men behaving badly and getting away with it,
yeah.
That's across our society, and that is being modeled every day in the workplace. It doesn't have to be in Hollywood. It's across all of our workplaces. You said, you know, most women in the Me Too hashtag, so many women have experienced it. So last year at Berkeley, when we had these sexual harassment cases, my female staff talked about their own experiences with sexual harassment. Almost all of them had some kind of experience during their careers of being sexually harassed. It is very pervasive. It's not an epidemic. It's the word we use is endemic. It's ongoing, high level in our society, across our society. And it's part of that cultural piece that we have to address the culture. And part of addressing the culture is us as bystanders not allowing our peers to get away with that behavior.
A lot of this reminds me of one of your colleagues at UC Berkeley that we've had on this radio program a few times, John Powell.
Yeah.
Who does a lot of important work for concerning implicit bias.
Absolutely. John's great.
Yeah. I mean, he opened up the world for me in so many ways in the conversations I've had with him over the years. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he says is that it's like racism is in the air. You mm-hmm. breathe it. You don't. You're not aware of it, mm-hmm. right? It's like, is a fish aware of the water that it's mm-hmm. swimming in? Mm-hmm. And I imagine it's very much the same thing.
Absolutely.
As sexism, yep. Sexual harassment.
Yep. And again, it's usually people in more powerful positions abusing that power.
Is it just powerful? Because
I think it's interesting. It's a good
in this
question.
In this dynamic, culturally speaking, yeah. haven't men traditionally been in the powerful position?
Absolutely.
Regardless of?
Yeah. Yeah. However, it's a really good question because many of the men that I've worked with in domestic violence treatment groups, battery intervention programs is what we call them, many of those men feel very powerless. It's interesting, you know, this concept of power. Many of them have felt very powerless in their upbringing, in their current jobs. They're angry at their supervisors, and there's a lot of anger, and they bring that home and take it out on their partners. But in that intimate relationship, they're the more powerful one. So while they may feel at a larger level powerless, they are using their greater physical power against people that have less power in their lives. So the women in their lives and the children in their lives. And many of the men that I've worked with, while they're angry at their supervisors and they're feeling powerless at work, many of them will never express that towards their supervisors. That anger comes out towards people that are less powerful than them. So I see it as, you know, some people talk about, well, men are, they're losing control. I actually think domestic violence in particular and sexual harassment as well is a very controlled kind of behavior. They're not using it with everybody. They're using it against people that they know that they can coerce. So it serves a function for them, and it's very directed specifically. So I had a man in one of my groups on Monday afternoon. He tore up the living room, broke everything in the living room, and one of the other men in the group asked him, what about the television? And he had not touched the television. Why is that Monday afternoon? Monday night football.
Yeah.
It was very functional. It was there to scare everybody in his home, but he didn't destroy the one thing that he cherished, which was to watch his Monday night football.
I've heard incidences of domestic violence reach their highest of any day of the year is during the Super Bowl.
I've heard that statistics. I don't know if it's an urban myth or not. Uh-huh. I just don't know. I don't know the data on that.
We are in conversation with Jeffrey Edelson. He is the dean of the School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley, and we are talking about men and violence. You've indicated earlier that you're hopeful. Are you hopeful for societal change?
Absolutely. If you look again, I said a few minutes ago, over the centuries, murder rates have gone way down across our societies. I am very hopeful that people can make change. I'm a social worker, and I truly believe in rehabilitation. Some people disagree with me, but I do think when people are found guilty for sexual harassment or something like that, or domestic violence, that they should be given the opportunity for treatment, and they shouldn't necessarily be expelled from our society. By expelling them, we marginalize them and isolate them. And I think we have to engage them in change. And frankly, over my 40 years of doing this work, I have seen many people make tremendous changes in their lives. We're capable of doing that as human beings, and I'm very hopeful about the change. And I think these experiences, while they're horrible, what Harvey Weinstein and others have done, as they become more public, I'm hopeful that we as a society slowly bend the arc towards positive change and a more nurturing and less violent society.
How does that happen?
Uh-huh. Well, I think it happens really through civic action in big ways. The Me Too campaign is a great example. I think by raising the awareness, by showing how universal this experience is for many women, and then by changing how we interact with our peers, the values that we hold as a culture, and those values then get played out in the laws that we make. So, you know, the laws are really a reflection of our culture, and we need to implement cultural change at the macro level around media, how we interact with our families at the micro level, and in the intermediate area around how we legislate and what we define. Just as I said, you know, child abuse was just sexual abuse at one point. Then we added physical abuse. Then we added other forms of abuse. And so we need to expand our definitions of what is abusive and show that there are consequences for it. People will change their behavior if they know that there are consequences for it.
It really seems like this Me Too hashtag campaign has, mm-hmm. has opened up a space mm-hmm. right now and an opportunity right now. Right. But we're the ones that have to make the change, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, this has to be, men have to initiate this. And we're hearing from women. We're not hearing as much from men.
And the domestic violence movement for a long time has been considered a women's movement.
Yeah.
And I think women have led the way on it, and that's great. And I see myself as an ally, a male ally in that movement. I don't know that men have to take the leadership on it, but a lot of it is the source of it. We do have to change.
Yes. I mean, I'm not saying we have to take the leadership of it as well,
but
how do we make that happen?
Yeah.
How do we change as a society?
Yeah. Well, I think we stand up against the kinds of behaviors that lead to this kind of violence and harassment. And again, I come back to bystander. We all have a role in this. We all have a role to play when we hear a sexist comment, denigration of a woman, when women are talked over in a meeting and their ideas are ignored. There are all kinds. It's like the implicit bias that John Powell is talking about.
Yeah.
There's implicit sexism that happens every day in the workplace.
That's right.
And every day in our social interactions outside of the workplace.
And that's everyone.
That's everyone.
Talking about everyone.
Yeah. And we do have to change that. We have to become aware of it. Just like with implicit bias, we have to be alert to it, we have to be sensitized to it, and then we have to take action to remove it from our society.
There are people listening to this right now that are dealing with domestic violence right now. What would your message be to them as somebody who works with men who are domestic abusers?
My message to the men would be that you can change and that you can have nurturing, supportive relationships. And in fact, your life will be much better if you take the violence and anger out of it, if you work to really have a different perspective, say different things to yourself, and behave differently with the people around you. So I'm very hopeful. I've seen many men make change, so I'm hopeful about men and hopeful about making change. And I'd say to women that look for support, there are great programs in our communities, but also there are probably many people in your lives who can support you to be free of violence, to live a different life, and to have your children live in an environment free of violence. That may include that male partner. It may not. Most of the relationships I've seen do break up over time. But men, once they do change, can go on to have constructive relationships and good, positive, nurturing relationships if they do the hard work to make that change.
And socially, getting back to the social here again, if you want to say anything more about the individual, I'm happy to hear it because it could be helpful to anybody. But it just occurred to me when we compare sexism and racism, I think people today are much more likely to call out racism than sexism, than the men are willing to call out sexism. We should approach sexism the same way we do racism. I'm not saying that we've eliminated racism. Obviously, we haven't.
No.
But I've much more frequently we'll hear somebody call someone else out for a racist comment.
I think we have to see those issues as in some ways related about people's power, privilege, being used against those with less power and privilege. And we need to call it out, be it racism, be it sexism. And I think there's a lot of alliance that can be built in between those movements. They often are not necessarily allied, or the focus, sometimes we feel like, well, if we talk about one, we're pulling the focus off the other, and vice versa. But I do think that they're related in the big picture, and that we do, just like with implicit bias, we need to call out implicit sexism and eliminate it from our lives and our workplaces.
Are there any societies internationally that you know of that have taken a hard look at this, that do deal with this, that don't have?
Yeah.
I mean, there are obviously societies that don't have the level of violence that we have.
Yeah, certainly there are societies that don't have the gun violence that we have. And that's clear in Europe. You can see the number of murders with weapons is substantially lower than the U.S. I don't know that I can say, I've worked all over the world. I've worked in Asia. I've worked in the Middle East. And sadly, I think the levels of domestic violence are similar across many of our societies. And we all have to do work. And the U.S. has done a lot of great work on domestic violence issues and men's use of violence, but we have a long way to go. And when we have models at the top of our society that are giving contrary messages, every day we have to push against that.
If it's similar across cultures, then what does that say about the learning of how we learn about this? If you also see it similarly in other cultures?
Well, I think the way in which boys and girls are raised in a variety of cultures
are similar. Yeah.
You know, there are extremes and variation, and even within different religious groups, there are variations. But the messages are generally that, a man's home is his castle and his kingdom.
That's what it comes down to, right? I'm the man. I am the boss. I am the king.
I had a man in one of my groups say, "This is God-given to me." And that was his rationale for being in charge and coercing the women and children in his life. I think that cuts across many different religions and many different cultures.
Yeah. Jeffrey Edelson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Again, Jeffrey Edelson has been our guest. He is the dean of the School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley. And that does it for Letters in Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez, Abby Klinkenberg, and Lucille Rousseau. Our engineer is Kristen Thomas. If you'd like to find previous shows, you can go to our archives at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jesrich, and I thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Helena Norberg Hodge, Big Picture Activism. Local Futures, also known as Economics of Happiness, is an organization founded by Helena Norberg Hodge. They are pioneers of the new economy movement that is dedicated to the renewal of community, ecological health, and local economies worldwide. In July 2017, Helena Norberg Hodge spoke at Schumacher College in England. She began her Earth Talk by recalling the experience that changed her life, her visit to the remote region of Ladakh in northern India. Ladakh had escaped colonial domination until the late 1970s. In 1975, Helena Norberg Hodge found an almost intact traditional culture. But by the late 1980s, Ladakhi culture had been dramatically changed and many of their values destroyed, not by war or slavery, but by the introduction of globalized trade and consumerism. Here is Helena Norberg Hodge.
I had come out as part of a film team. I wasn't planning to stay for more than 6 weeks to help make a film. As a linguist, I'd been asked to both help with the sound of the film but also to pick up a bit of the language. Well, in those 6 weeks, I just totally fell in love with the people. I had never, ever encountered people who seemed so vital, so full of joy. And so when the filming was finished, I stayed on. And I ended up doing research and doing a basic dictionary of English Ladakhi. The spoken Ladakhi was sort of a modern form of Tibetan, and that had not been written down before. I went through the whole region with these relatively small villages and one capital city. I never, ever saw any sign of hunger. I never heard people complain about being undeveloped or poor. In fact, people would say to me, oh, you must stay in the winter. That's the best time of the year, because then we just have festivals. You know, in the summer, you know, there's quite a lot of farming work. Now, I saw over a 10-year period how that incredible self-respect and their whole attitude to themselves changed because of what we call development. In came tourists. And in came ideas about a Western life that looked like it was a complete paradise. It looked like we do no work. Because when tourists came to Ladakh in the early days, spending $100 a day was roughly the sum that a Ladakhi family might have in a year. In the early contrast between a culture where water, food, housing, medical care, basically, everything you really needed was without money. So money was only for luxuries. And in fact, their money at that time was traditionally had been more in the form of stones, turquoise, coral, pearls, gold. And the women had most of that jewelry. But Western anthropologists were coming in. And I realized over the years that partly what they were doing, of course, was judging the culture by Western yardsticks, and they'd see that men and women sat separately at public functions, at weddings and so on. And that seemed to them like women, didn't have the same power as men do. It was also the men who went out and traded, who traveled much further away. The women tended not to go such long distances. But I would say, having grown up in Sweden, that in Ladakh, the status of women, the status of the feminine, was higher than in Sweden. In Sweden, probably out of the entire industrialized world, women and the feminine have a higher status. And I still say that over the years, what I came to discover was that the structures, the whole way of life, made women and the feminine empowered that so much more. Now, it was a whole series of things. You know, one of them was that because they lived in intergenerational communities, every mother had roughly 10 caretakers for every baby. When you have that situation, if a child is ill or, you know, if there's a problem, no one gets tired or irritable or, you know, it's so easy. And that, of course, affects the child hugely. Now, I don't want to say this to make anyone feel bad or guilty for having grown up in or living in a typical Western context. But what I'm trying to promote is a vision of a more localized economic structure that could help us all regain many of the basic wealth of a culture like that. You know, we can't go back to living like the Ladakhis, but there are certain principles that are very important. And one of them is much more community contact and much more contact between generations. Also in Ladakh, when schools were brought in, which weren't there before, that when you put children age one in a room all day, you're creating a universe of competition and elbows. You cannot reach out a hand as a one-year-old and help the other child walk. You're physically incapable of that. Now, what happens, and I saw it out there, is that when children are mixed of different ages and with adults and in constant interaction, there's a natural process of learning and teaching that is lifelong. The modern day schooling that we have was brought in together with industrial production and to train up a workforce. In Ladakh, it was so clear that when children had gone through schooling, they had been trained for a job in the urban sector. In other words, in a sector based on fossil fuels and materials which were not available in Ladakh. They learned nothing about food production, nothing about building a house, nothing about providing at all for basic needs. Later on, if they became specialized and went to agricultural college, then they would learn about a few pesticides and hybridized seeds and hybridized animals that were meant to be appropriate for Ladakh. And I saw how on the radio, you know, people were starting, the agricultural experts as part of development were promoting, among other things, DDT and other pesticides that were outlawed in the West. I also saw that with animals, the experts were bringing in Jersey cows. Now, in Ladakh, the grazing land was up at about 18,000 feet. I mean, you had to certainly go over passes of about 18,000 feet to get there. You had a very well-adapted cow and a mixture of the yak and the cow called a dzo that were able not only to go up to those high pastures, but they spent months, they were sort of semi-wild. It was lovely, lovely to see them because they really were their own masters. And then at the time of harvest, they would come wandering down. And sometimes they go off to another valley and you meet people who were running, you know, looking for their yak or their dzo. And they sometimes decided to come down too early and then they had to be escorted back up again. But bringing in Jersey cows, what did that mean? It meant bringing in industrial pellets, importing the pellets to feed them. And then, yes, they gave more liters a day than the typical local cow or yak, but nothing like the same nutritional quality of what these animals had from up. This is just one small example of what's happening with a monocultural development model based on fossil fuels, based on forms of production that are simply not compatible with the needs of the earth, with the biodiversity of the earth, and that are not compatible with different cultures. I just want to say something also about the psychological impact of the outside culture coming in, which came in through schooling, through radio. At first there wasn't television, and advertising, tourism, and development experts, most of them Indian, coming in. The message was, your culture is backward and primitive. You've got to do everything you can to become as Western as possible. And for the boys, the image was Rambo. It was so clear how these role models polarized and made a joke of gender roles. For the girls, it was literally Barbie doll. Blonde, blue-eyed Barbie dolls. And I saw women who previously had been strong and able to do things and respected for their abilities in the economy suddenly become so self-conscious and so passive. And I saw that depression, particularly among women, started coming in. I saw that with the young men, what started happening is that here they were being trained to be this modern Western man in this modern economy, and that meant earning money, and the jobs were very scarce. So almost overnight, by creating a scarcity of jobs, by creating unemployment, this modern economy created conflict and competition between people. So what emerged was a conflict between Buddhists and Muslims to start with. And it was clear that when you rob men of their self-respect as their identity, to be who they are, and then you rob them of the ability to provide for themselves and their family, it's a recipe for violence. And it's a violence that will also mean turning against your own community, your women in your community, children in your community. It's just a terrible way to run a society, to run an economy. So what happened is literally that by 1989, there was violent bloodshed between Buddhists and Muslims. It was very traumatic. And I had already, before that, been so passionate about trying to say to people, wake up, wake up. This economic development model we have is simply not working for human needs. This tyranny of monocultural images affects all of us. I want to say that also as an invitation as to why I believe that big picture activism has this huge potential to bring us all together across racial divides, across cultural divides, across left and right politics, across, you know, grassroots to the top of business and government. We all, if we see the big picture, we will all have a reason to join in a systemic transformation of the economy. I have become convinced that we need to look at the way that our economic system goes back to a trajectory which really started with very big, wealthy business leaders. I mean, you know, it started with the kings and the rich sending traders off across the world. I mean, traders is not the right word. In the beginning, they were robbers. They were going to rob people of their wealth. And from having seen this economic transformation in Ladakh, and also later I worked in Bhutan between 84 and 89, and I saw exactly parallel changes to Ladakh. And again, people would say to us, this is our story too. The story you tell is what happened here. So it's very clear that we have not been aware of the fundamental structures of this economy and how it has its roots in colonialism and slavery. When traders were able to set up a situation where you had poor people over here and rich people over here, the global traders were able to amass more and more wealth and power. This process led to the birth of these giant corporations. part of this system, too, is banking and what happened to banking and who has the right to make money. I'll come back to that. So this system really has continued unabated, but we haven't been paying attention to it, particularly in the last 30 years. So by the mid-80s, what had happened was we were no longer talking about the power of corporations. Basically, what we have seen in my network is that this process of trade treaties, which is really what globalization is, it's a process of agreements between countries and multinationals. And those multinationals are pressuring our governments to give them more and more freedom, the right to go in and out of national economies without any rules, without any constraints. And there are even clauses in the treaties now that say, if you do anything that might risk my making potential profit out of your country, I have the right to sue you. And so countries are signing in black and white, yes, you can sue us. So I just want to summarize by saying that I feel very optimistic now. You know, no guarantees or anything, but I feel very optimistic that it is totally possible that we will see a major wake-up to the central reason behind climate change, unemployment, and particularly those two are so important. Because at the moment, people are being led to believe that they either it's their jobs or it's the environment. And they're voting for Trump and other leaders who are taking us in a disastrous direction. But behind unemployment, as well as climate change, as well as the extinction of species, as well as an epidemic of depression and anxiety, particularly among young people, the loss of democracy. And even if people don't see the loss of democracy, most of you will recognize that more and more governments are having a very difficult time creating a government. The instability and the swings are greater and greater throughout the world, in every country that I know of. Why? It goes back to the fact that the real government has become these businesses behind the scenes. Now, I am really seeing that everywhere you go, more people are waking up to that systemic root cause behind the instability, the poverty, the environmental problems. Beginning to see we must make an economic shift. We need rules. We need to regulate instead of deregulating. Now, the re-regulation is only going to happen through international collaboration. So in what we call big picture activism, we are talking about connecting with like-minded people as the number one thing. So we talk about connect, educate, resist, renew, and celebrate. And what we mean by connect is don't go at this alone. Try to find even one or two like-minded people near where you live. Try to meet regularly. If you can't meet them near where you live, then maybe connect with some of people on the internet who share your thinking and have some Skype meetings now and then. When you change the I to a we, you open up a very different avenue of thinking. You suddenly have more power. You suddenly are thinking differently. The next thing is to educate, and it starts by educating ourselves. There are so many layers of assumptions now. I mean, one of them has been that poor countries shouldn't need to lower their CO2 emissions. The rich countries should be lowering their CO2 emissions right now. It's a completely corporate agenda. The corporations, through globalization and trade treaties, were moving to where labor was cheap. They needed to have dirty, polluting factories in China, in Vietnam, in India. So to then have Western environmentalists campaign saying that poor countries shouldn't need to reduce their CO2 emissions. It's all been because of a lack of the big picture. If we understood globalization and the big picture, we would not be lobbying for the people in the poor countries to have more pollution and to have big factories where they have more or less slave-like conditions. We would be understanding that worldwide we would be better off strengthening local economies, shortening distances, and particularly around food. So the localizing part is what I call renewal. The resistance part is resisting the escalation of the juggernaut, resisting particularly the more trade treaties, and part of that resistance needs to lead to a political shift towards regulating global banks and corporations. Now, on the other side, the renewal is already happening all around the world. Everywhere you look, you will see the most inspiring and heartwarming changes that absolutely affirm that human beings are not greedy and aggressive by nature. For me, this is the most important message maybe that I have. Don't allow yourself to be told that, oh, the human race, you know, we're just like a cancer. We deserve to extinguish ourselves. I hear people saying that these days. Please don't fall into that trap. And please just look, you know, at any little child you can see and know that all of us are born longing to be loved. And if we get that little bit of love, we're usually going to be quite loving people. And love is a very, very important driver. But the most important movement that I see worldwide that is so fundamental is the local food movement. And it is a global local food movement. But again, we've not been allowed to see it because it should be spelled out as the systemic and incredibly healing movement that it is. And we should be learning about all these initiatives around the world that are demonstrating that small, diversified farms are much more productive than large monocultures can ever be, ever. So structurally, we must move towards diversification. And it's happening around the world. They're proving that it's more productive and it's more job rich. So people have more meaningful work, and there's a whole new farmers' movement emerging where young people are wanting to farm. They don't want to stand in a monoculture being told by a satellite and computer what to do, you know, bending over all day like a machine. That type of agriculture, which also grew up with a type of slave-like economic condition, and where even now we have migrant labor behaving like machines, that image is what is fed to us to make us think that, of course, we must have more and more technology to replace people. In actual fact, when you see what artisan production looks like, particularly in food and farming, but even in things like pottery, house building, many community localized small-scale forms of providing all our basic needs are much more satisfying, use much less energy, are much less polluting. The only reason we can't do that is because of an economic system that's imprisoning us. You know, we need to see our way out of it. The shift in subsidies away from encouraging every business to use more energy and technology and dump people. That's what we're doing right now as a system, worldwide. More energy, more technology. We subsidize that. We subsidize it from university, even in the schooling. That's what you're trained up for. If we shifted that to support really full employment and small-scale, flourishing economies for basic needs. Basically, we want to look at a world where society shapes business rather than business shaping society. Now, society shaping business means that you and I need to be informed about how money is made, right now it's a sham. It's a Ponzi scheme. It's absolutely criminal that a few financial institutions can make money out of thin air and then spin it around in this casino-like speculative system, you know, literally controlling the value of our currency, of our water, of our clothes, of our democracy, and of our ideas. If you learn about the incredible benefits of localizing, of renewing, of regenerating, restoring ecosystems, restoring the community fabric, mental health, there's so many wonderful, wonderful projects out there. So the final word is to celebrate, and that is to remind ourselves also in a whole embodied contemplative way, allow ourselves to shut out the chattering mind that thinks about the climate change and Trump and all kinds of things that don't make us happy, to just allow ourselves to become calm and embodied and full of joy, joy at everything that is still working so well. And it can just be reflecting on the miracle of the living world. So appreciating that beauty and that wholeness, that health, and how much is still working and beautiful is vitally important. And we urge in the celebration that we also bring back the sort of celebration that we had for our entire evolution until this modern, rather destructive economy. We used to be much more participatory. We developed many more skills. We were able to make things with our hands. We were able to do, some carpentry, some pottery. We had broad range of skills. And one of maybe the most important was singing, dancing, and making music. Very simple line dancing, Sufi dancing, the sort of thing that we did throughout our whole history. And that's incredibly enjoyable. So celebrate is a central part of rebuilding the local fabric, the participatory fabric, the local economy from the bottom up. And it really is an economics of happiness. Thank you.
That was Helena Norberg-Hodge. She spoke on July 26, 2017, at Schumacher College in England. Helena Norberg-Hodge is a pioneer of the New Economy movement and recipient of the Right Livelihood Award. Her book, Ancient Futures, describes the Ladakh experience and has been translated into more than 35 languages. She is the producer of the award-winning documentary, The Economics of Happiness, and director of Local Futures. Thanks to Schumacher College for this recording. You can see the 50-minute video of this talk on YouTube. This college was inspired by E.F. Schumacher, the economist, environmentalist, and author of Small is Beautiful. Visit the website for Local Futures for dates of upcoming conferences and workshops. That's www.localfutures.org. You can find links on the website for this radio program, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. And you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Harpers Ferry National Park is located at the confluence of the Potomac River and the Shenandoah River in the easternmost corner of what is now West Virginia. This tiny national park, just over 1 square mile in size, is the location of the 1859 raid led by John Brown, a white abolitionist. Outraged by the sustained existence of slavery in the southern United States at that time, John Brown and his armed supporters snuck across the river at night, attempting to take over the government arsenal and arm the nearby enslaved people and foment a revolution. Brown's intended efforts were ultimately unsuccessful and resulted in his conviction for treason and death by hanging. Nonetheless, he foreshadowed the growing discontent of slavery that would lead to the Civil War that began 3 years later. In this edition of Radio Curious, we join George Best, a national park ranger, on a tour of a portion of Harpers Ferry National Park and stories about its rich history. He tells his stories amid the background sounds of the rivers, railroads, and other machinery, and begins with a description of the foundry, the largest building in Harpers Ferry, with a 90-foot-high smokestack.
This is a massive factory. It will, on average, produce 10,000 weapons a year, for all just under 600,000 weapons in total during its lifetime. Behind you, these foundations. These are the two arsenal buildings where the weapons were stored. And where we are right now, this is called Arsenal Square. This is where the weapons would have been tested. Each weapon is supposed to be loaded with a double charge and fired to make sure it's not going to blow up in a soldier's face. So, as an armory worker, you have some incentive to do your work right. This is the complex that George Washington envisioned and eventually would be built here. Now, it's not all built overnight. It takes many years to build up to this. But even in its early days, during the War of 1812, for example, its first real test, our first major war after the Revolution, it averages that full 10,000 weapons a year. And it churns everything out. And these arsenals are empty, as they have just shipped out everything to supply our soldiers out in Ohio, Louisiana, and Baltimore, and Washington, D.C. These guns are going all over the place. Also, because of its close proximity to Washington, D.C., Harpers Ferry has a lot of weird stuff that the Springfield Armory in Massachusetts doesn't have, because we're close to all the congressmen and the patent office. So anything new that wants to be tested out, it happens here. Harpers Ferry is also producing rifles, which Springfield does not do until 1855. Harpers Ferry starts this in 1803. And also, Harpers Ferry will be the site of the first true example of interchangeable parts being produced in the world. In 1811, a man named John Hall, he's from Maine, he's tinkering around and he invents a way to produce truly interchangeable parts. Just in case we're not 100% clear on what this means, think about anything you use today. For example, a light bulb. That's a really good example. As long as you see the size of the socket, and you know exactly what kind of light bulb you need, you can go into Home Depot, Walmart, Lowe's, whatever, walk up, be like, I need this kind of light bulb. Oh, we got three different brands. Well, they're all going to fit. Screw it in. Bingo. Done. These are all interchangeable within the same model. Prior to this, no, not so much. You know, things may look very similar, and even to the naked eye, they may look exactly the same. Because they're being handmade, things are going to be ever so slightly off. So, for example, in weaponry, if, you know, you break a screw and you need a replacement, it's not going to fit perfectly. Also, if you and a buddy are cleaning your guns next to each other and you get your parts mixed up, oh, it's going to be a nightmare putting your guns back together because his screws aren't going to fit in your gun and vice versa. And trying to separate all those, really difficult. So, John Hall has invented a weapon, a rifle, that is completely interchangeable. It is all machine-made. Everything is exactly the same. 1813, it gets tested. And in 1819, the government doesn't just give him a contract. They hire him. They make him a assistant master armorer of Harper's Ferry. They build a whole separate factory down on what's called Virginius and Hall Islands. Starts out with just a few storage sheds, which he very quickly turns into a state-of-the-art factory. And by 1823, 1824, he is in full production. So that when the government comes to do an investigation to see, you know, are we getting our money's worth, he has 100 guns ready for Congress. He takes them all apart, mixes up all the parts, everything goes back together perfectly. No other country in the world has achieved this. They get close, and Eli Whitney, as I'm sure many of your textbooks in school said, invented this. He got really close, but it was all just very careful handwork. John Hall is the only one doing this 100% by machine. And this will revolutionize the very way we live. Over the next 20, 30 years, the American Industrial Revolution will be very focused around this idea of interchangeability and mass production and machines. Much more so than the great industrialized nations of Great Britain and France and what will eventually turn into Germany. They don't have this. And they start to realize this after a while. They start referring to this as the American system of manufacturing. And they want to know, how do they do it? What's their secret? So in the 1850s, the British, the largest, most powerful, richest, industrialized nation on Earth, wants to know what piddly-poo little Cousin Jonathan, that's what they called us, Cousin Jonathan, was doing across the pond there. They send a commission to the United States, and they go look at several large industrial cities. Among these are Pittsburgh, Chicago, and of course, Harper's Ferry. By this point, Harper's Ferry and Springfield, everything between the two factories is interchangeable. So you can have a gun made in Harper's Ferry, you march up north with it, you break a part off, and you can get a Springfield part put on, works perfectly. And they start sneaking around trying to figure out, what are these guys doing? And they start hiring American workers. James Henry Burton, the master armorer here at Harper's Ferry, will take a nice, big, juicy paycheck to get on a ship and go to England and take over the Enfield Rifle Works in England, their largest producer of military weapons. But even then, by the Civil War, when we're importing large numbers of these Enfield rifles, they're still not interchangeable. The American ones are. And many of the soldiers who have Enfields start to grumble about it because the parts don't fit quite right. They want those Springfields over there that do fit quite right. And so this is kind of like, we are in space-age technology here in Harper's Ferry compared to much of the rest of the world. This is truly the heart of the American Industrial Revolution in this place. Now, there are a few fun stories on the sidelines here. We've got lots of labor issues that pop up. The biggest one involves alcohol. A lot of the armory workers in the early days, they were allowed to drink on the job. They would keep big jugs of whiskey on their work tables, and they would pound it down, and so long as they met their quota, didn't matter. They're getting the job done. We're good. Yes, you drinking on the job while you're making firearms. Very smart. So, and of course, whiskey was the big drink at the time. And eventually this gets to be a bit of a problem, and they decide no more drinking in the armory buildings. And much to their surprise, there's no pushback from the workers. They thought there would be a strike. Nothing. They do notice, however, the workers are opening and closing the windows very frequently. And what was eventually discovered was, and there are different versions of how this goes. We'll go with the most common one we see. They had stuck hooks outside of the building, or laid it on the ground if they're on the first floor, big buckets of whiskey. And they would lean out with their cup, so they're technically outside with their cup. All right, close the window, back to work. And so they're drinking still, but they're not inside the armory buildings. They're out in the open air. So they found a way around the rule. And then, probably the most tragic and largest event to take place in Harper's Ferry, the big spark in Harper's Ferry's history, will take place with the armory in this little building right here. Now, I've described it was built in 1848, our newest building. Also, that cupola on top, that wasn't added until late 1859, early 1860, so take that off. This is the armory's fire engine house. It also has a little room for the night watchman. His job is to go around with a lantern and make sure kids don't play in the middle of the armory and there aren't any fires. And if there is a fire, there's a bell tower nearby. He can go out, ring that, sound the alarm. The fire brigade comes out. They put it out. Well, this will become more famous as John Brown's Fort. John Brown is a white man born in 1800 in Torrington, Connecticut. And he will grow up an ardent abolitionist. Indeed, he will say in a story later in life that he vowed his life to abolition at age 12. That something happened that made him really an abolitionist. And he believed that he was one of God's instruments in making this happen. And religion was a very important driving force in his life, and it would guide him on this continued path of ardent, stern abolition. And so he will grow up. And regardless of what he did, he had many, many failed business practices. He was a very hard worker, had no sense of money whatsoever, was incredibly stubborn, and usually any discussions, whether they involved money or whatever, would always somehow turn to either religion or slavery. And so he rarely actually got many of his businesses going, and in many cases he cost himself and a lot of other people a lot of money. But he never gave up on the hope of ending slavery in the United States. He would build a little secret compartment in his barn in Pennsylvania to hide slaves on the Underground Railroad as they moved north to freedom in Canada. He never joined any abolitionist organizations, but he worked closely with many of them. But finally, by the 1850s, he declares war on slavery. Literal, with guns, war. He fights out in Kansas, becomes a household name for the Pottawatomie Massacre and the little fight on the Osawatomie Creek. And then he has a much grander plan. With a small band of men, he will sneak into Harper's Ferry, which one is in Virginia. At the time, there is no West Virginia. Virginia has the largest slave population in the United States. A little over 10% of all the slaves in the United States live in Virginia. In fact, Virginia has a surplus of slaves. Now, how awful does that sound? A surplus of human beings. And they are selling them to the deep south on the cotton plantations and getting very rich off of it. They're basically running a human baby factory. And, of course, we've got the Harper's Ferry Armory and Arsenal here. So, John Brown is thinking, large recruiting ground for an army that I can help the slaves fight for their own freedom. I can train them to be soldiers. Those who cannot fight, I can make a big highway in the mountains and take them up to Canada to freedom. Those who wish to fight can stay with me. I will arm them. And when we come into Harper's Ferry, this will be the great trumpet blow for freedom. He wants to take whatever weapons he can, sneak out of here, burn anything he can't carry with him so it can't be used against him. And then the mountains are the key. Hide up there. Dart out every so often. But if you have the high ground, you have a big advantage. And that is where he will hide. He sneaks into town October 16, 1859. With a mixed group of white and African Americans, 21 men. They will spread out throughout the town. They will take several prominent citizens hostage. But eventually, on this next morning on the 17th, the militia begin to turn out. Things start to go wrong. The first raider killed is right about where this fire hydrant is today. His name's Dangerfield Newby, a former slave. The first civilian casualty of the raid, in fact, the first casualty overall, is a free African American named Hayward Shepherd. Shot because Brown had stopped the train, and he went out to investigate. But it was dark and rainy. He heard Brown's men yell, "Halt!" But none of the men with him, and Shepherd himself never heard that word before. And so they turned tail and ran. They saw strangers in the dark with guns. Those strangers in the dark opened fire. The only man killed is Hayward Shepherd, a free African-American, one of the people John Brown wants to help. And that will kind of set the tone for the rest of this. It goes very badly. By the end of the 16th, John Brown and his remaining men are crammed in this little building here. This is where he's forted himself up, thus John Brown's fort. He will knock a few holes in some of the walls so he can stick his guns out and shoot out at the militia. The militia charge forward a few times, but they're unable to get inside the building. They are able to rescue a few hostages from the watchman's room. That's really about it. Meanwhile, word has reached Washington, D.C. of what is happening here. And the only federal troops available are all 100 United States Marines. So they board trains with two cannons, and President James Buchanan finds the highest-ranking Army officer who is actually capable of moving. Winfield Scott was very old, weighed about 300 pounds, was arthritic, had gout, And so he was still very sharp in the head, but movement not so much. Also, keep in mind, when I say he's 300 pounds, also remember, the guy's 6'5". So he's a massive man. Also, if you ever find a picture of his horse... So we can't really send him out. Even though he's a brilliant military commander, no. But the next highest-ranking man we have available is a colonel, home on leave just across the river in Arlington, Virginia. Robert E. Lee. So they snag him. And there's this little lieutenant named James Stewart, or Jeb Stewart, who's been harassing the patent office about this new saddle he's invented. They're like, yeah, why don't you go off with Lee? There'll be honor and glory out there. And so he attaches himself to Lee as an aide-de-camp. Lee will come here in charge of the Marines, take command of all the militia out here. So he's got about 1,000 men under his command. Brown has at most 10 men left. 10 of the Marines will stay across the river with the two cannon, then the other 90 will march into town. He will split them into three teams. Team 1, 12 men armed with sledgehammers to bash the doors down. Team 2, they're the next in line. They're the men with their muskets and bayonets at the ready for the assault. Team 3, everyone else, muskets and bayonets, ready to go fill in as Team 1 and Team 2 do their job. So Team 1 comes down. Lieutenant Israel Green, the actual commander of the Marine Company, charge down. They start bashing on the doors. Brown has reinforced them, and so the sledgehammers are unable to knock their way through. Team 2 comes forward, and they find a ladder. They'll pick this up and use it as a battering ram and bash against the door again and again. And finally, they break open part of the door and knock it partially off its hinge. They got a big enough hole they can fit through it. Lieutenant Green is the first man through, his sword drawn. Remarkably, not a single shot touches him. Next man through, Private Luke Quinn, an Irish immigrant, recently joined the Marine Corps. He is shot in the stomach and will be the only Marine to die. Next through is Major Russell, the Marine Corps paymaster, who's just along for the ride, with his wicker cane. He will go charging in. And then Matthew Rupert, Corporal Matthew Rupert, will be shot in the jaw, but he will survive, probably minus a few teeth. And the rest of the Marines will come in. The fighting takes about 3 minutes. Brown is knocked unconscious by Lieutenant Green, and his remaining men are captured or killed. And Brown's raid, his hope for freedom, is over. He's taken over to Charlestown, Virginia, the county seat. He's put on trial, and he's found guilty of 3 things. Murder, treason, and inciting servile insurrection, or trying to start a slave rebellion. And for these, he is hanged on December 2nd, 1859. In his last message, John Brown will write on a piece of paper and give it to his jailer. And it reads, I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away, but with blood. I had, as I now think, vainly flattered myself that it could be done without much bloodshed. Of course, a year and a half later, we get the American Civil War. And it is that Civil War that will spell doom for Harper's Ferry in a major way. We're actually going to go out to the point where the two rivers meet and give you an idea of some of the destruction the Civil War caused to this place. You're going to follow me again?
We're listening to National Park Ranger George Best on a tour of Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, recorded on October 12, 2017. This is Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.
April 12, 1861. The first shots of the Civil War are fired. By the end of that week, the Harper's Ferry Armory will be gone. Confederate soldiers are advancing on it, attempting to seize it. They want those machines. There are over 10,000 weapons in storage in that building, in the arsenal buildings. They want those too, but those state-of-the-art machines are what they really want. The Confederacy is going to need those to make weapons for themselves so they can make their own independent country. To prevent this from happening, the badly outnumbered Union soldiers, there are about 50 of them, they will light the whole thing up and it'll go up in flames. Armory is gone. Now, the townspeople rush out and are able to save most of the machines, regardless of which way they lean politically. And this area is a little leaning slightly gray. Further west in Berkeley County is pretty blue. But they were more concerned about, if that goes up, that there goes my paycheck, there goes my way of taking care of my family. I need to save those machines. And so they're actually able to save about 80% of the machines. But Harper's Ferry is done for. Those machines are loaded up onto trains and sent to Richmond, Virginia, and Fayetteville, North Carolina. and Harpers Ferry goes from a bustling industrial town of 3,000 people, once the envy of Great Britain, to just being a ghost town of maybe 300 people. Its population has decreased by 90%. Buildings abandoned. This is where the railroad station would have been. There would have been hotels and restaurants here. This is downtown. This is the business district of Harpers Ferry. You notice there's not a whole lot left. February of 1862, Confederate snipers are hiding in these buildings, shooting Union troops across the way. The Union commander across the river, John Geary, has had enough. He marches his whole force across here. Well, I guess boats them across. They don't march through the river. And he burns all the buildings out here. So now there's nothing left. Eventually, the Union Army will fully occupy Harpers Ferry and make it a massive military base. They want to guard the railroads here. The Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, which still runs today as part of CSX, that is the most important railroad in the entire Civil War. It is the main east-west line for the North, and the Confederates do a lot to try to disrupt that traffic when they can. So the troops here are actually nicknamed the Railroad Brigade, because they are guarding the railroads. The town changes hands a total of 8 times. 80% of the war, though, it's in Union hands. And by 1864, they have transformed it again into an even larger supply depot. The armory buildings are cleaned up, re-roofed. They're turned into barracks, storage rooms, kitchens. They're turning out thousands of loaves of bread every day. Trains are coming and going constantly. Soldiers marching through. Spies sneak into Harpers Ferry, too. And many of the major operations in the Shenandoah Valley will be based out of here in Harpers Ferry. So this place, it is now not just a city of 3,000 people, it is a city of tens of thousands of soldiers, depending on what time you're looking at. And it will be attacked again around Independence Day, 1864. The Confederate soldiers are out on what's Schoolhouse Ridge, Bolivar Heights area, which does belong to the park. The Union troops are up on Maryland Heights. During the night, both sides would sneak a few men into town to take some pot shots at each other. But one Confederate soldier hears rumors. There's a store in town, and it's got barrels of molasses. And you know what? That sounds pretty tasty, given that I've been eating green corn and bug-filled bread the last several years. And so the soldier sneaks into town. He's borrowed a mule and several buckets so he can get some of that very sweet molasses. A little flavor in life. And he knocks them open. He fills his buckets. And he ties them onto the mule. And then he just leaves them running so the Yankees have a nice big mess to clean up in the morning. And so he's leaving on his mule. And he gets just over the crest of Bolivar Heights. And the sun's coming up, so he's silhouetted. Union cannoneers up on Maryland Heights, they see him and go, you know what? Let's take a pot shot at him. Let them know we see him. Fire the cannon, completely misses him, but it spooks the mule. Effing takes off and keeps running for miles. A few hours later, the soldier and his mule stroll back, rather sullen into camp, dripping in sticky molasses. His fellow Confederate soldiers are so desperate for something else besides what they're usually getting for food, they're going up to him with their hardtack, the bread that they've got, and wiping it off of him and the mule to eat. After the Confederates left, they came back into town, and their Union soldiers who complain about someone left a big sticky mess in one of the stores, and they had to clean it up. Now, once the war is over, Harpers Ferry has many, many, many deep scars. Many of these buildings are wrecks. They have holes in their walls. Some of them were completely torn down. This area was burned. The armory is gone. What is Harpers Ferry going to do? It tries to rebuild. Probably the most successful thing that will take place here is the establishment of Storer College in 1867, a place where anyone, regardless of race, gender, or creed, could get a higher level education. Although it traditionally was an African-American school. It was a place where former slaves and later on their descendants could go to receive an education. And it will graduate many, many students, the most prominent of which is probably Nnamdi Azikiwe, the first president of Nigeria. There's also Don Redman, the little giant of jazz. There's the Lovett family that would run the large hilltop house, the luxury resort of Harpers Ferry. Today it's kind of falling into the river. It is condemned. People do not stay there. There are plans to renovate it, though. It's been an ongoing process, so maybe someday the Hilltop House Hotel will once again open its doors. Storer College will close its doors in 1955, after segregation is outlawed. With segregation gone, the state of West Virginia figures, what is the point of African-American-only schools? They can go anywhere now. So they pull their funding, and the school, which was struggling financially already, has to close its doors. It has no money left. And so the buildings, many of them are torn down, but the few that are left now belong to the National Park Service. Two of them are where our headquarters are. Also, Mather Training Center today occupies Anthony Memorial Hall, the main campus building. It's still an educational facility. There are two training centers for the Park Service, for park rangers in the country. One is here in Harpers Ferry, the other in the Grand Canyon. And eventually, the park will be coming to being on paper in 1944. Its first buildings are acquired in the 1950s. And eventually, this will come to include the area where you're standing on. Most of the lower town district up here, a block up High Street and Potomac Street, it becomes private. Most of the Storer College campus and then surrounding battlefield lands. We have land up on Loudoun Heights, actually most of Loudoun Heights, most of Maryland Heights. We have Schoolhouse Ridge and Bolivar Heights, and recently we acquired the Allstatt Farm. All of it going to be preserved. So for future generations, for you all to learn something of the past.
George,
yes.
Could I ask you the questions I ask each guest at the end of each program, the three short questions?
Sure.
One of them is a eureka or an aha moment in your life that changed your life.
Yep.
When I first came here, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my history degree, just something with history. Came out here and realized, as just as on a whim, I took an internship out here, and I realized this is what I want to do. I want to be a park ranger. And I've been very fortunate in that. I've been a park ranger since 2011 now. I hope to keep being one until I can't work anymore. And that was the big eureka, I guess.
The next one is, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
I just want to keep, you know, sharing the stories of our past with, you know, everyone else. You know, it's a very important part of who we are, and I want to keep doing that and find more of these stories to keep adding on to it and keep making the story more accurate, more real to, you know, the people I get to share them with.
And finally, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
I would say Dave Gilbert's Walker's Guide. It's a very good one. Goes through building by building, but you can read it in your living room just fine. Let's see, The Strange Story of Harpers Ferry by Joseph Barry. It's dated. You do have to keep your salt shaker handy while reading him. He embellishes a few things, but a lot of the really interesting and fun stories we get from Harpers Ferry, a lot of them we pull from that book. And then if you want to do more specific to the Civil War, I would say Harpers Ferry Under Fire by Dennis Fry, our chief historian here. That is an excellent one to get you the perspective on all of the Civil War stories that happened here.
Well, National Park Ranger George Best, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious on tour in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia.
No, thank you.
George Best is a National Park Ranger based at Harpers Ferry National Park, West Virginia. The books that George Best recommends are A Walker's Guide to Harpers Ferry, West Virginia by Dave Gilbert, and The Strange Story of Harpers Ferry by Joseph Barry. This program was recorded on October 12, 2017, at Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. There are over 500 editions of Radio Curious on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free to listen, download, and share as you wish. The email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnestad is the assistant producer, and I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.